Welcome to Biggest Geekest. We are your hosts. I am Joe.
And I'm Randy.
This is episode 33 of our podcast, and the date is April 21st, 2021.
What's up, homie?
Well, quite a bit. Well, a lot of stuff behind the scenes we were just talking about.
But high tech behind the scenery, yeah.
Yes.
We may have some news, maybe a guest sometime in the future. Fingers crossed.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Was talking with the anti-cancel culture wing of
OSR
gaming crowd. OSR, mm-hmm. I don't know if they're all OSR, but
right.
They're pretty friendly, I think.
Yeah.
So that's good. Good stuff. Yes. Good. So today we are doing gaming inspiration.
Yes. We're going to stop off in the positive material plane.
Yes. And we've got a pile of call-ins, a very big pile. I think this is a record for even Jason.
Nice.
So Jason called in, and we're going to start with that.
Hit it. Hey guys, Jason here. Just want to respond to the call segment. I've stopped at that. We haven't left the positive material plane yet. But as far as gaming online, and I'm probably going to work backwards here. Sorry, I'm in the car. But as far as gaming online, when you guys get ready to get into that, don't worry about virtual tabletops having to do Roll20 or Fantasy Grounds or any of that malarkey. Just use Google Meet or Zoom or whatever, you know. If you can see your players and you can hear your players, use physical sheets, roll dice. If you use Zoom, you can do screen share, so you can share maps, you know, and you can enable it like a whiteboard so people can just put an X, yeah, I'm here, I'm going to move around this corner or whatever. Don't worry about tokens and all that crap. Just play the game. Just look at each other and talking. At least try that, because the virtual tabletops turn into a video game and they turn to something else.
Jason, dude, we have done that. We talked a little bit about our Savage Worlds game that we put on hiatus till Cabin Con, but we did the Zoom a while back, maybe a 6-8 months ago, when the COVID stupidity was high. We were playing Deadlands on Roll20, and that was not ideal. And we switched to this fantasy Savage Worlds game, Zoom, roll dice, and I even figured out how to use my iPad with a little whiteboard to do that. So it was okay.
Yeah, I think it's like he said, it's a lot better than it's a lot better than using one of the virtual tabletops that a lot of people like. As I didn't make the video game association, but I think he's pretty correct on that.
I think for me, the only way I would consider that is more investment, like a tabletop, and maybe pay for the fantasy ground stuff, as if me and four or five people are like crazy into online gaming. But as it is, that's probably the only way I'm ever going to online game is in that format if I'm GMing.
Right, right. A lot less trouble.
Yep.
As far as would I cut back on online gaming if I had a chance to play an in-person group? Yeah, I definitely would. I would definitely play in person over online if I had the chance. But that said, online gaming has pros. You know, I play with people all over the world, you know, and that's great. It's wonderful to be able to play with my British friends and, yeah, people in all over the world. Play people, over the years, I played people in South America and Australia, New Zealand, England, Ireland. Rob's over, he's not from Japan, but he's living in Japan currently, all over the U.S., so Canada. I think there are a lot of pros to online gaming as far as, you know, getting a much wider group to play with. But in person is definitely a better experience.
I can kind of agree with that, just because I kind of got a Brit fetish. Now, if you look at my podcast, I listen to several Brits. I know Joe's giving a weird look to me here, folks. But, I just seem to be listening to a lot of the – I kind of want to listen to a podcast. I mean, like John Allen, Barry at Shadow the GM. Was it Che for a little while? When I hear them at Roleplay Rescue, when I hear them talking, it's not just their accent, which is pretty cool. Most people can agree, but it's just I don't know. They seem to have a mentality about gaming that I can be with a little bit more, you know. but it may not be. It may be something else. It may just be that they're, you know, just kindred spirits in terms of gaming and
probably
played with others. It wouldn't be that, but that's pretty cool for Jason.
Yeah. Just one note though, there is a sizable contingent of folks on YouTube who think Australia is fake.
What?
Yeah.
Wow. That's a note. That's a comment. That's a comment, Joe.
It's very weird.
Okay, then.
As far as where I mentioned Mithras Classic Fantasy voting on the character concepts, so I don't want to talk too much about that game because there's a couple things going on there that aren't really public knowledge at the moment. But the deal was because we weren't able to, we got together and kind of did a session zero online to talk about character concepts and talk about the ground rules and all. But then the GM said, hey, okay, we're going to break. And everybody come up with a couple character concepts, throw them up. And this is a GM that's more into the backstories than he is into the physical parts of the character. He wants to know what your passions are and what your aspirations are and what your fears are so he can build that into the campaign, which is really cool. But that's kind of why he wanted character concepts. And what they and so he said, throw out three character concepts, and then we can kind of look at them as a group and see what might meld together as the best party.
Oh, okay. That I was kind of, yeah, because I was thinking at first, I was like, so they make decision whether you get to play the monk or not? I ain't down with that. But no, that sounds cool. You're trying to get, yeah, everybody's trying to get something like, you know, I don't think Joe's Vorpal Wielding Butch would be a good fit. I think it'd be better if he played this super weak first level magic user with nothing.
Yeah, you would say that every time.
True, good point.
Every time.
So it wasn't so much that everybody's going to vote and say, well, you're not allowed to play that character. But if you came up with that, you know, goth loner that doesn't want to get along with the rest of the party, or that, you know, paladin that's not going to fit in with the rest of the party when everybody else wants to play evil characters, which we're playing good characters. But point being, if you came up with something that was totally wrong to the rest of the party, that would get vetoed. The other reason for the character concepts, though, was to make sure that people didn't come up with the identical concept. We didn't really want to have a bunch of duplicate concepts. You know, he was looking to have a little bit of niche protection and a little bit of, you know, differences in the characters. So that was the reason for that. But I think it was more to kind of see what everybody else was thinking. And I don't know that anybody isn't playing their first choice, to be honest. So my experience is going to Tandy Leather or going to the hardware store or going to the thrift store and buying stuff and modifying stuff and making your...
I skipped one.
I was going to say that. I thought so. Sorry, Jason. We'll get you in order, bud.
And like I say, I've done a bad job explaining that because there's some things going on in that game that I don't want to talk about online or, you know, on the air. But overall, it's not as bad as it initially sounds. I've just muddied the waters here. But the intention was to eliminate characters that would totally derail the game and to eliminate people basically playing copies of each other. That was the purpose. As far as the SCA goes, yeah, I don't know. It wasn't that expensive when I was in, but maybe it was just the group I was with. I was when I was in the SCA, I was in Washington State in the 90s, because I had a break in service. I was out at Fort Lewis at the time, but yeah, I mean, it was a lot of fun. But we made our own armor. You made your own stuff. You had to buy materials, but we weren't buying made armor. So my experience is going to Tandy Leather, or going to the hardware store, or going to the thrift store and buying stuff and modifying stuff and making your own stuff. And so it's maybe a little bit different. I don't know what the current rules are as far as armor and all that. But yeah, your weapons were pretty much rattan weapons that were wrapped, you know, in tape. But it was a lot of fun. The royalty thing, yeah, some people took that too far. You know, the way the kings worked, at least then, was by combat. So the best fighter, in theory, is going to be the king of that, you know, kingdom. But there is a lot of skill to that combat. It's interesting. It really is. Now, the knights and things like that in the realm, typically you had to have some other knowledge. To get knighthood, you had to know different arts and different things. It wasn't just be able to fight good.
That was kind of, so you said tan swords? Is that a, is
rattan.
Tan coat?
Rattan.
Okay. I was like, so the sword's painted tan. I'm not sure I want to be fighting someone whose sword is just painted tan and mine's a piece of wood. Yeah. So.
Yeah, it's a resin of some.
Gotcha. Okay. Cool.
But I have to admit, we maybe didn't take it quite as seriously as some people did. I mean, we took it seriously. You know, we're involved and, but I don't know that we were as, you know, none of us were that worried about being knights. Or, well, that's not, you know, that's not true, though. Tony was a knight. He was a knight, before, he was a military guy, and he came out, but he hooked up with us because the mercenary band was fun to hook up with. But, yeah, I don't know. But I played a Norman because I like kind of that, the armor options and the look, and so I did like a Norman persona. And, yeah, it was a lot of fun. I don't regret my time in the SCA. I know there were a lot of politics. I was shielded from a lot of that and didn't have to deal with it. But, yeah, it was really good times and a lot of fun.
Hey, Joe, I have a question. If it wasn't expensive, would you do it now at our age? Would you consider it or not? SCA.
Probably not. I wouldn't have any time for it.
I don't think if I had time, I'm not sure I would. Cause I'm not sure my, you know, like I was thinking, I'm, you know, I've been losing a little bit of weight, not much, and but I'm exercising harder. And I just think though, as my bike's going to be finished soon, I'm hitting the road pretty hard soon, and I'm going to get down again, lose some way more weight. But I don't know if my knees could take that much. I don't know. Maybe it'll change.
I don't really even like dressing up for the Renaissance fair.
True, I'm not a big really. Halloween guy anymore. So yeah, maybe this wouldn't be our bag anymore.
Right.
I 100% agree that you, the GM, when you design the game, or if you're doing it together, you can do it with your players. If you're working on this campaign idea together, whichever version of that you want to do, you can control the classes in there. There's no reason every game has to be a kitchen sink game. I think it's a sadder world if you don't have ninjas in there, but I think that's totally valid choice, you know, if you want that sad world. Anyhow, as far as spell systems go, what I like to do with D&D game, what I like if I'm going to modify a D&D game for a spell system is you just keep all the same rules as far as how many spells everybody gets. But hold on one second. Anyhow, you would take your spell slots that are already in there and you just have it where you can do spontaneous casting. You know, the spell cast just a rest or whatever, but you don't pick specific spells every day. You can just cast any spells in your repertoire. That lets you use those odd spells that never get used. And you would be able to use your higher level slots to cast lower level spells. So you might have, you know, 3 level 1 slots and a level 2 slot, and you can cast a level 1 spell through that level 2 spot if you want to. But I think that's the easiest way to do it. It's not quite spell points, but I think that's the easiest modification for the D&D system, spell system, at least the older versions. And it works pretty well, lets you get all those spells out there. And it doesn't, you don't have to worry about coming up with special spell point rules or this or that. It's already kind of baked in the system. But that's just me. Anyhow, on to the main topic.
You know, that's actually something I did, Joe. Back in second edition, near the end, I was with clerics, which is funny I chose them because they had all the bonuses, all the benefits from armor and fighting, but I let them cast free. They just had their slots and they could, because my thought thematically and narratively, it seems to make sense that a cleric, why are you memorizing Flame Strike? Why are you memorizing any spells? It would be like, Odin, great and powerful god with the one eye, give me the power of Flame Strike. At the moment, you need it. And it would be interesting to try that, don't you think?
It would be.
Even with wizards, just say, look, that's how it works. And if you want to burn a higher level slot to cast a lower level spell, that's great. And if we wanted to get fancy, we could even have, you know, higher, like Monty Cook's Arcana Evolved, and say if you burn Magic Missile in a second level slot, maybe it gets +1 or +2 per missile. If you burn it on third level slot, it's D6 per missile. I mean, you can do stuff like that.
Just, you that's could.
Not a, that is not the worst idea.
Not the worst. Okay, I lost my space.
10, I think.
okay, I'm going to do something dangerous. I'm halfway, I don't know how far away I am, and you're known unknown, but you just talked about the 5% chance of failure. But let me get my thoughts up to now, because, you know, my memory is not as good as it ever was. So, as far as character knowledge, PC knowledge, yeah, it's difficult. I've definitely been in games where people do things that are much greater than the PC's intelligence would allow. I really like the idea of group sourcing for smart characters, though. Because if you're playing a fighter that's really good at tactics, and or you're playing a wizard with an 18 intelligence, and you as the player aren't a super genius, or a tactical genius, then you might not know the things that character really would know, you know? And I think group sourcing, saying, hey guys, what do you think? And they say, you know, everybody in the group gives input, and then you use the best out of that. I think that's totally valid.
I agree. That's perfect, actually. That's what you should do it.
Yeah.
You skipped one.
The players.
On 11.
I thought I just played. Oh, I played 10.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with mysteries. You know, if you have 18 intelligence and you're playing the sleuth, another one would be charisma checks, right? You're doing that fast talk thing, and you want to play a Han Solo, or you want to play a real smooth, like a Dirk Benedict face character from the A-Team, but the player isn't all that smooth in real life. Well, I don't think it's wrong to group source, you know, what kind of con you're going to play on people, and then have that charismatic character do that. You know, I think that's okay, and I think enhance the game. I think you have to be careful with it, because if you devolve into 10-minute sessions where everybody's talking, like you say, it'll pull you out of the game. But I think having other people, if the player wants help, I think it's okay to give the player help. I do think you have to be careful other players don't bully that player into what they should do, because it's the optimal choice. I think that's dangerous. But, okay, next point.
Yeah, offer help. Don't be overbearing.
And don't play the character.
Yeah,
don't play. Yeah, that's true. That is definitely a danger doing that. The group has to understand what the limits are.
Right.
I would say wait till the player asks for help. Don't offer it.
The player's plans being hidden from the GM. I'm fine with this. If the players want to brainstorm a plan, that's fine. The GM knows what they're going to do ahead of time. That's fine. Or, you know, the GM knows this layout. And you just react to what the players say. And if it makes sense, fine. Now, I do like your idea of, and I would happily purchase your product of your smart, what a smart villain would do and what a dumb villain would do. I think that's a great idea. And, yeah, I think, but just because the players tell you they're, so I guess maybe I'm misunderstanding. Normally, I don't ask the players, tell me your entire plan, and then I go work up what the villain's going to do, I work up plans with that in mind and then play the game. I let the players tell me as the game's going. So maybe I play a little different than you guys do. But, yeah, I don't have any problem with them knowing their plan, not sharing their full plan with me in advance.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Jason. I think I was just thinking how I felt in the past. But the more I think about it, I mean, yeah, we play the same way. It's not like I say, Joe, tell me every single move you're about to make in the next 47 rounds, right?
Right, so, and you have everything. Well, you're Mr. I prepare for every contingency type
try,
of
thing. Try so to.
It's not like you wait for us to make a plan and then do your thing.
No, my thing's
it's
done.
If you ask anything at all, really, it's what are you guys planning on doing? I think sometimes you might be doing that, you know, to try to help.
Yes, sometimes I am.
But the other thing is, sometimes the bad guy's going to sometimes know because they're spying or something.
Yeah. I think for me, a lot of times, and when I think about what I said last week, I probably have to soften my and I think I did mid-podcast too. I think I like the idea of players surprising me. I guess the time I don't like it is when, and I've gotten this surprise, I picked this new spell I didn't tell you about until right now at this moment when you're fighting the Balrog. And guess what it does? It's a second level spell that paralyzes Balrogs if they don't make a save versus spells at -10. And I'm like, where'd you get that from? all from this book I bought. It's official. And I'm just like, I think those surprises definitely bother me more. And my partner here is really good about not doing that. If he has the Balrog paralyzation spell, you know, and Joe knows that's likely to be a foe of ours, because if it was a Balrog, you know it's coming, he'd say, Randy, I want you to know I picked this spell. Is this okay? Because, I mean, if it comes out of anything but the core book, I think you'd need to, that's a different podcast, but I think you need to ask permission.
Yeah, I started doing that after observing a few meltdowns.
It's common courtesy, especially when you pull off, you have some weird class combo that's only found in these, you know, last couple of plat books that nobody has but you. Man, that's cheese ball.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
As far as the 5% chance to miss, you have to and I know we're talking sword fighting, gun fighting, locks picking, whatever. So there are two things here, right? One is, really, we only want to be rolling the dice when it's interesting or when we have interesting outcomes. Now, combat is always going to be interesting outcomes. But if it's just a standard lock and you have a 20th level thief, yeah, maybe it's interesting if it fails to pick it. But maybe you just assume, yeah, you pick that lock and get in the room, right? You know, maybe it's not worth making that 20th level thief roll for every single lock. Now, there might be times, like you're in the dungeon, you know, a stress environment, you do have them roll. But if it's not really a stressful thing, then maybe you just say, yeah, you pick that lock and you move on. I don't know. But when we look at the real world statistics.
Well, you know, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Do the next one. Okay, he's finishing something.
Yeah.
Okay, let me back that statement up. Let me not talk about real world statistics. When we look at the way people are trained, like you talk about gunfighting. So you look at the training and the standard acceptable or not, pretty much what trainers will tell you is your skills degrade 40% between the practice, you know, when you're in practice and in real life. So when you're under real stress, the idea is, and the generally industry accepted standard is, your skills going to degrade 40%. So that's something to think about. And obviously combat would be, you know, when that's going to degrade. Now, somebody that's in combat friggin' all the time, you know, is it going to degrade as much as Joe Blow that's in combat, you know, once and he's, you know, never been in combat before? So I think there are variables in that as well. But I think 5% chance is fine because it's a game.
Yeah, I agree. I think he makes a good point, too, about a 20th level thief against a common lock. Yeah, I mean, honestly, I wouldn't have that thief roll. No way.
Right, right.
And you've seen me do it. You've seen me do it when I play. Oh, yeah, you're too good. You're too good for that. You do it.
Yeah. The idea of routine not needing a skill check is pretty – I think we're pretty much on board with that. The other thing is that 5% that can be represented by a number of things. And I can't remember if he does that, goes over this or not, because I listened to these already. Randy has not, because I'm a jerk and didn't let him listen to them until now.
No, it's okay.
That 5% could represent any number of things. You could have slipped in the mud. A birdie could have flown in front of you and blocked your view momentarily. Maybe you burped up because you ate a haunch of loin 10 right. minutes before you swung your sword. Any number of things.
And I think it's just to add fun to the element. I mean, what fun is it? Like, all I got to do is reach level 12 and then I hit everything I swing at.
Right. I mean, that's what fun is it? That's what he's saying. It's a game.
Yeah.
So you got to make some allowances.
Yeah.
We're not simulating reality.
No.
Because maybe they didn't miss. Maybe the bullet hit got stopped by the Bible in the pocket. Or maybe like you said, I mean, you have cops killed by 22s all the time, unfortunately, where, you know, it goes through, like in their armpit where the vest isn't covering, protecting them, right? And so that kind of stuff happens. So there's always going to be that chance of that kobold getting a lucky strike in. And there's always the chance of missing due to some freak thing. So I have no problem with that 5% chance of failure. But you guys are going to talk about that a little more here, I think. So, but I think the key is it's not a simulation. And a lot of those games I rattled off that you guys weren't familiar with them, Morrow Project, Phoenix Command, some of those others, the Tri-Tac systems. You know, those are built trying to be realistic, and they go super, super complicated. And I really don't, in the long run, I don't think it's worth it. I think on that Complication Center, or Aftermath, the old Fantasy Games Unlimited game Aftermath, it's interesting. And if you like to do it like as a just an interesting, but they're more simulations and games at that point, right? And I don't think it's as interesting if it takes a minute's worth of calculations to figure out where the gunshot hit and what happened with it. I don't know that that's as satisfying as just rolling on the Rollmaster, you know, firearms table to see what happened, right? I think you need to have some abstraction in a game. It's not a simulation. And I think having that chance to miss is necessary in a game. But let me listen to what you guys have to say about that.
Yeah, I can agree with all that. Some abstraction is needed.
Yeah.
I think some games suffer from being overly abstracted.
Yeah, but like the idea of taking 2 or 3 minutes just to decide whether you hit or not, that's crazy. Yeah.
That's kind of a problem. Or the weird, like he was saying, it's one thing to consult a single table,
mm-hmm.
right, and then have some interesting effect happen a la Rollmaster. And it's another thing to consult several tables, which is probably what these other systems have.
Yeah.
I've seen stuff like that. Consult table B, consult table ZZ, you know, blah, blah,
well,
blah.
Well, we experienced that with Rollmasters. I think maybe, you know, Rollmaster is due out with a new edition soon. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm going to take a peek at it.
Yeah, probably.
I don't know. There might be a way it could be played. Because remember the guy we played with, Aaron, dude, he was money. He was a great GM. And he made it run smooth. But he was running multiple. He knew all these, you know, all these little, you know, not side examples. What's the word I'm looking for? Exceptions to the rule, special cases. Right. He'd go to the tables, and he told me that all these different tables, there was like table GG and critical table FF and blunt critical table B. And I was like, if you know it really well, it can probably run smooth. It just seemed to me on the surface when I looked at it, I was like, that just seems too complicated for me. I mean,
right.
Well, convoluted.
Yeah.
Fine as a player. I'd play Rollmaster with someone like Aaron GMing any day.
Right, because he knows all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you would need a computer program to plug everything into to give you a result, which to me, kind of weird.
Well, that's what I heard Rollmaster was going to have. They were going to have an app to come out for free when it came out that does all that for you.
No thanks.
I agree that DMs should not intentionally play the party against themselves, you know, design encounters specifically around the players. I think every now and then, like you say, it's interesting to throw something in there as a ringer just to keep people on their toes. But like you say, everybody that shows up shouldn't counter the invisibility flies stone skin spell. So I think that's, yeah, you shouldn't intentionally nerf the characters. I think it's fine for NPCs to lie and deceive characters or to not have full knowledge themselves and unintentionally lie. But yeah, I think, like your example in the tavern with the fireball and the ring of fire resistance, I definitely think it's appropriate to throw the fire spell first, and then after that first round, it's fine to react to that cleric as if he, you know, is resistant to fire. So, yeah, I don't think anything too controversial there. As far as knowledge of campaign settings, yeah, I kind of like the way you guys have outlined there. You know, I like the idea of the Points of Light world where, you know, you just fill them in as they go and they don't know a lot about the outside world or the greater world. For monsters, what I really prefer to do is never name the monsters. So I'll describe the monster and the players say, oh, that's a troll. Well, that's fine. They can call it a troll. And maybe I'll call it a troll after they call it a troll. Or maybe I'll just keep saying the monster or the creature, but actually if they say, okay, well, your troll does this, but it may or may not be a troll, but I'm never going to tell them, okay, you're fighting a troll or, you know, this is a Freddy or whatever. Right. So, and that way they can still kind of use their knowledge, but they may, you know, you get what I'm saying.
Yeah. What do you think of that, Joe? So if you were playing a table and you guys go, oh, it's, and you say it's a troll, and then Deb says it's a troll, and then Dave says it's a troll, and then I start saying it's a troll, and then at the end, you guys have this something, you know, it's like really hard. You can't hardly kill it, and maybe you lose a character because it's really, you know, you're surprised you finally kill it. And that, what was that troll? What kind of troll was that? Like, oh, it wasn't a troll. Would you be upset at me for having said it's a troll?
Along with no, you guys? Not necessarily.
Especially if I said, you guys said it first. I was just using something to I had to give it a name because you guys called it that. That's right. Not what it is, and I'm not telling you. You got to figure it out.
Yeah. Well, that goes only so far depending on the campaign setting.
So, yes.
Everybody knows what a dog is.
Yes.
So I don't think maybe I'm being a little pedantic here, but it may only be for rare or uncommon things.
Right.
But there's going to be some known things.
Yes.
And if what he's saying is true for the things that are not well known, mm-hmm. or knowledge is sketchy or unreliable for some reason, that's one thing. But if there's orcs all over the place, like in Middle Earth, everybody knew what an orc was. There wasn't a this is an orc if you say it is. This is an orc.
Yeah, well, I think what he's saying though is like, I think his implication is he doesn't want to give away the beast, but sometimes, like, if I pick a monster out of a third party, you know, supplement, or grab a Hackmaster journal and pull some crazy beast out of there, I'm not going to tell you the name immediately. Having said that, if you guessed it, or if you're like, that's a this, and you start calling it that, sometimes I get tired of saying the creature or saying trying to come up with cool ways to describe it, and I'll just say, yeah, that's what it is. You figured it out.
That makes sense.
Yeah. I've done that. I think Jason's got good points. I mean, there's nothing wrong with doing that. I think it's good for a GM at times to be cagey. He needs to be cagey about things.
At times.
Yeah. At times. Yeah, at times.
Yeah. Well, he's okay. I'm going by what he said. He said he never tells them what the monster is.
Which is, I wonder. I wonder if he would do that if they're fighting. If they fought 47 orcs in a row and they figured out they were orcs, you still wouldn't call them an orc?
Yeah. So there's, I'm sure there's some, he doesn't
qualifiers
that there's not all the qualifiers.
Yeah. There's probably qualifiers there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe I'm different because as a GM, I'm more interested in the play, in the emergent play, and I don't get that much out of writing the fiction ahead of time. So I'll come up with the adventure ideas and all that, but typically my worlds are generic fantasy world or generic sword and sorcery world or generic space world where, you know, the space is the Wild West and you're galactic marshals or like U.S. marshals, right? So I'll try to do that. I'll come up with the figures, but I don't sit down and write a 75-page document on my game. Yeah, I don't have a game Bible for each world or setting Bible. I know people love to do that, and I'm not putting that down. I'm just not creative like that. So, but I think if you do that, as long as you, if you want to give characters bullet points or whatever, I think that's fine. And I think it's fine for characters that know about magic in a world to know how spells work in the world and whatnot.
Agree with that.
Just like it's fine to have clerics or a character that would know that is into religion. They may know about religions of the world, but your average if you have a world with a variety of pantheons, which I'm not a fan of anyway, but say you have a bunch of different gods, then, you know, somebody that's into religion, a priest, a cleric, might know those things, but the average guy might not. But on that note, I kind of like to have one pantheon in a world, in a setting. I don't like to have Greek gods and Norse gods, because I think I can get messy. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense unless you're going to have the gods fighting. I kind of like to have one pantheon, but maybe I think on smaller terms than you guys, unless high adventure or high magic, high fantasy, whatever. I'm more of a smaller scale kind of guy, but that's just me. Anyhow, let me listen to the rest of what you guys are saying.
I like to comment on that. That's interesting. So I agree that a priest might know the gods in the, for example, in a region, if your campaign is contained all within, let's take Greyhawk, you're all within the environs of the city of Greyhawk, and there's a set of old say, and I know this is not right, but the old Suloy's deities, and that's all that you use. It would make sense that most people worship one of those. Having said that, in a world like today, my personal opinion is I think there would be multiple pantheons that would be worshipped. Or I've always liked this idea. To make it easy for me, especially back when it was third edition, back in second edition, when you wanted to have specialty priests for all the gods, I would have one pantheon, but they would be worshipped by different names by different cultures, because that happens too. Roman and
Greek
both have different names for the same deities. But I get what Jason's saying. If you're running in a small region, in the Hamlet region and Verbabunk region, which Hamlet's part of, then I could get that you would say, yeah, I'm just going to deal with these guys. There's not going to be any other crazy gods in my campaign. But I tend to go, if my campaign runs what I prefer, you will be world traveling and you will be meeting different priests of different gods, different religions, and very different from your home. So,
right.
Yeah. I don't mind if you have 27 pantheons in your campaign composed of 27 gods.
We did actually do the Greek Norse and Roman rumble.
We did.
In our early days.
We did. We each side summoned those gods and they fought.
Yeah.
It was really weird, but fun. Go get them, Thor.
Just like it's fine to have clerics or a character that is into religion. They may know about religions of the world, but your average.
I think I played that.
Yep.
See, this is the problem of calling during the show and said, listen to the whole 3-hour plus show is, you know, the idea of crowdsourcing ideas. Now you're talking about as far as puzzles go, and I've already left you a message about it. I'll just assume you listen to my message before you finish recording the episode using your time travel device. As far as players talking about mechanics, you know, like hit points and healing, yeah, it's a game, so I don't think you can get around that. I think narratively the only way to get around that is that the players don't have their character sheets. The DM controls the character sheets. DM controls all the mechanics. You know, we've talked about this before. And the players just respond to what DM says. He's, oh, you're feeling weak. Oh, can you help me, healer? Yes, I will do this to help regain your strength. But, yeah, you feel stronger than you did before, but you don't feel 100%. You know, but that's the only way around it, really.
Yeah, Jason, we've already traveled forward in time and know exactly what you're saying next week so we can have comments. I'm impressed that you've noticed that, aren't you, Joe?
Say that again?
That we've, Jason, recognized that we're time travelers. We actually go forward. We didn't this week, hear his messages and then come back and we answer them in the podcast because we know what he's going to ask before he asks it.
Right.
But I have no interest in controlling the player's hit points and armor classes from them. It's not because it may not be more, you might get really involved and players may not be sure of what they can do. But I don't know if I'd want that from a 20th level wizard. I'm not really sure what I can do. You're a freaking archmage. You ought to know what you can do. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We really ought to sell those plans, though, and become filthy rich, which is what will happen.
Yeah, we would probably.
Of course, keep the prototype, leave a couple of details out so they can never make them work. But right. Be that close.
Yes. And if you want to know how to do it, we will make them and we will operate them remotely. Mm-hmm. But you cannot have access to control because we got to keep that money flowing to us.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I say that's the only way around it. I guess the other way around it would be to do something like get rid of hit points and go to conditions. So you just have conditions and you just have, you know, where you're weakened, kind of like Savage Worlds, right? Where you're weakened, but instead of having three wounds or whatever, you just have one wound. So you're either wounded, wounded, severely wounded, or dead. And then you have conditions like weakness or, you know, slowed or, you know, dazed, whatever. But it's still mechanical, though. I mean, it's a game. Play the game, right? Okay, let me get back to the show.
Did I skip one?
I don't know. It looks like it went from 20 to 22. I think that was a...
Well, there's nothing in between there. So he numbered
okay.
Wrong.
Okay, go ahead. Move on. Go the next one after a 22.
So I did click on 20.
You did.
All right.
As far as perception checks, I agree with you. The quote-unquote middle ground you know, not just saying I roll a perception check, but not taking 10 minutes to describe everything you're doing. But I do like for players to describe generally what they're doing. Like you say, I'm gonna check the room. I'm going to start with the table in the center, and then I'll check the bed. Then I'll move the bookcases. You assume they're checking everything when they're each area, but to say what order they're going to check it in is fair. And then you have them roll. I'm down with that. Passive perception, I don't know. It rubs me the wrong way, to be honest with you. I don't like that. I'd almost rather the GM roll a hidden roll behind the screen. I'm not big for hidden rolls and rolling behind the screen. But I'd almost rather the GM do that than that you just use this passive perception thing. But, I mean, I can see its use. And to be fair, in an earlier call, I did talk about, you only roll when it's interesting, and maybe that thief, automatically picks that lock when it's not interesting. So, obviously, you don't need to make perception checks every time. If there's really nothing in the room, you haven't checked the room, you don't bother rolling. The negative to that is that if the player's always rolling, then it's irrelevant. But if you, the DM, are rolling behind the screen, and you only roll when it's interesting, then they're going to know something's up when you roll. In which case, you need to make BS rolls every night. Just roll the dice that don't mean anything now and then, right? But really, if you have the players roll their checks, then it doesn't really matter. You just have... But, yeah, I don't know. I think passive perception just rubs me the wrong way for no good reason, to be honest. I guess I can definitely, from the narrative sense and the idea, you only roll dice when it's interesting. But then you don't need passive perception checks. You just, as a GM, make that determination if it's needed. But, yeah, I agree with the middle ground, ultimately. It's, the player describes generally what they're doing and the order they're going to do it. And then using that knowledge, you as a GM can either have them roll a check with a plus or a minus, or, you can determine whether they're going to have to roll that surprise to see if they're surprised when the thing comes out from under the bed. I'm with you on that.
I think maybe the next one... is related to, so we'll just play that.
Okay, yeah, we're trying to find the one we might have missed.
Players keeping secrets from one another.
No. Okay, so we almost have Jason liking passive perception.
Yeah, we almost got him. See, we carefully, when we were massaging psychically his brain, he's slowly coming closer toward it, and I see what he's saying, but I'm good with passive. I think if you roll every time, even if you make them roll for the easy lock when they're 20th level, they know you're rolling. So players get on the edge of their seat. The DM's rolling something, something's up. And I know you can make a few little fake rolls, but I'd rather just say if the players aren't being particularly careful, use passive. If they make it, fine. If they don't, then, whale the banshee trap. I don't know what to say.
Seems fair.
Players keeping secrets from one another. This is where online play shines, because you're already online, so it's so easy to send an instant message to the DM, or a lot of programs like Rule 20 as a way to whisper to the DM. So you're still in the program. The DM's not having to look at instant messages and texts and the program. Just where the messages show up in the program, it only shows up for the DM. It shows us what's called a whisper. So online play really lets you do those whispering back and forth and passing notes without other people knowing it. So it really does shine that way. I don't have a problem with it. I don't have, like you say, the problem is at the table, people see you passing notes. So obviously something's up, right? I don't know. I don't have a problem with being open with each other and just pretending you don't know the secret too.
I'm going to disagree with Jason here fully. We played online, both versions, and maybe it's me. You probably did it. Someone sends a private message to me, and I don't see it till 5 minutes later. And when I'm playing Zoom and my little iPad with the whiteboard, and I got dice, and I'm looking around, and my wife's across the table from me, and you guys are on the screen. I can't hear the whispers, and unless maybe Roll 20 has a sound, but we played it. You probably experienced it. I know someone has. I've had several folks we play with, Kelly and Pat, for sure. I remember sent me a private message, and I ended up asking them a question. They already told me what they were going to do. So it's, you know, I don't think it's ideal unless maybe it's just I'm old and I can't navigate online stuff. That's possible too. Who knows?
Well, I don't know if it's age that is the problem or just I'm not familiar with the tech. So yeah. You're not used to the user interface or the user experience. So.
And Zoom has private messages. You can do that on Zoom.
Sure. Sure. So, yeah. So all of that is new. So it's fine. Once you get used to it.
That's probably what it is. But so far, an application for me, it's poop.
Right. Oh, he skipped the number again.
Good for him.
26 no, and 28. So maybe
you're on 20. You're on 26, I think, aren't you?
I think so. Let's try it out.
Players keeping secrets from...
Nope.
Okay.
So while it's really cool if you can keep it a secret, if you're playing in person, you just have to say it and everybody knows what you're doing. It's the problem with that is if you're looking for those papers, you know, or you're a thief and he's trying to pocket a little bit extra gold on the side, then if you're honest about it and open about it at the table, then are the other players going to continually ignore the fact the thief is pocketing an extra tenth of the gold or whatever? Maybe, maybe not. You can see eventually players might get a little frustrated with that, where if they don't know, what they don't know doesn't hurt them to some degree, right? And I think a thief trying to pocket an item here and there is totally different than, you know, being a problem player, right? I think especially if it's established ahead of time, hey, it's a thief, it's what they do. I don't think that's such a big deal. Now, stealing from other party members is a different story entirely.
Yeah, I think if, as a player, Joe, if you were playing a thief and you were like, just saying, I'm going to try to steal this. So just you send it to the DM. As long as it wasn't something that was plot important or a magic item that you really shouldn't have, you know, if you stole a ring that was perfect for a thief, I wouldn't even get that mad, a ring of invisibility. Right. But I have to admit, a lot of folks like to have that ring, Joe. That's not very cool. But when it comes to money, you stole a 500 gold piece gem or a 10,000 gold piece gem, I'd be like, hey, that's what he do.
Right.
That's him. Good for him.
Right. Now this I don't know how well this segues into this topic, but it's as far as keeping. Well, no, this isn't a secret. Never mind. Okay. I was going to talk about booting a particular character who took a sword that he shouldn't have, and booting right, him off the top of a tower.
That was different. Yeah.
Yeah. That was a case of this is what my character would do.
Right. It was.
And my character did what he would do.
Right. And to that guy's credit, though, he did not complain about it.
He did not. He did
not. So, fair enough.
GM screens, interesting. Yeah, it is a good argument for those passive checks. No doubt about it. Or, yeah, it's a hard situation. It depends on your group. Some players are really good at playing that. You know, well, I know I failed, but, you know, not using that meta knowledge of playing. But I think eventually, even the, you know, the best player, it's going to dampen a little bit if they know ahead of time that they failed a check. So, you know, as much as it feels wrong to me, I think you might have sold me on the passive check idea to some degree. So maybe that's something else to steal from later editions. I don't know.
Ha ha, victory is ours.
Yes, we are quite persuasive, are we not?
Mm-hmm. He thinks we just look into the future. We actually affect his mind in the future.
Right.
Yes, we're psychotic. We're psychotic time travelers.
I know what I forgot to tell you guys about. So as far as the... Well, so as far as the novels go, I never liked TSR's... Not the D&D novels. I thought they were pretty crappy, to be honest. But that reminds me, you guys talking about the TSR novels in the final segment. when we're talking about mechanics and what do characters know about mechanics. Interestingly enough, Eric J. Holmes, Dr. Eric J. Holmes, who wrote the first basic set, the 81 D&D basic set, he wrote a novel called Maze's Apparel, or Maze Apparels. I think Maze's Apparel. Anyway, if you Google it, Eric J. Holmes, Maze Apparel, you'll find it. And it's set in the D&D world. And he wrote that like in the mid-80s. So this was fairly far along into the game's history. It was like, you know, at least a decade into the game when he wrote this novel. He also wrote some short pieces and fiction pieces in Dragon magazine and whatnot.
This one plays into it.
Okay.
Anyhow, the important thing here is in that novel, in Maze of Perils, there's this court hearing. Or is that where it came up? Anywhere, at some point in the game, they do go to court because a centaur got excited and he stepped through the floor of a tavern and he was being taken to court for damages. You know, so their D&D was a pretty gonzo world. But one thing, at some point now it wasn't during the court case. Anyway, at some point during that novel, the wizard says, "Oh, I'm only a third level wizard." He just straight out in his character's dialogue straight out says, "I'm a third level wizard." And so, yeah, what you're talking about, well, they wouldn't know they're this level or that level. Well, according to Eric J. Holmes, the guy that wrote the 81 basic D&D book, characters 100% would know what level they are. So there's that.
Well, I'm going to disagree with Eric J. Holmes on this count. The Dungeons and Dragons movie also referred to a level wizard. And the Dungeons and Dragons movie with who's the actor, the big actor that was in that? Jeremy Irons.
Yeah.
Stunk a big one up. It was pure poop. And now I could get with this if you narrativized it, made it story-like and said, okay, whenever a wizard says I'm level one, like they maybe in the D&D movie they did this, this is where I got it from, I'm on the first circle of power.
I've learned
the first circle of magic. I've learned the second circle of magic. And that could just be a level indicator. I've learned the 20th level of magic, the 20th circle. So if you narrative it up and story it up, okay. But I really don't want my players going, I'm only a level 4 fighter. I can't fight a lich.
The Masons have levels.
Fair enough. I just don't. Okay. So Randy doesn't want it. It just sounds weird, but maybe so. Maybe so.
Who knows?
Are Masons like level 2 Mason, level 3 Mason?
I remember hearing something about levels and Masons. I don't know what it means.
Yeah.
It could be some like urban legend kind of, you know, just inaccurate stuff. Who knows?
Well, they have rankings and they might have levels too. I mean, I guess, but it's weird. I'll go to third edition. I'm a fourth level commoner. Does the farmer know that? I'm a fourth level commoner.
Probably.
I guess you could do it, but it would take me out of the story.
Older edition of the game, they had level titles, so you could use that until you get to name level, and then you just refer to your name level. I'm a
lord.
Whatever. You know, it was magic user in earlier editions, and then it's 9th or 11th, depending on which version, you become wizard.
Yes.
And the arch wizard at some point.
Yeah.
Something like that.
So, I mean, yeah, I guess there's arguments on both sides. So, and I guess if I had to defer to one of the creators of the games that we love, it wouldn't be all that bad.
I guess not.
Yeah.
It still sounds weird.
I agree.
As far as YouTube and Cabin Con, you'll definitely get more viewers of the YouTube. You'll definitely get more people introduce the podcast if you do YouTube. So I definitely would never ask you or try to steer you away from YouTube. I would say I would hope you continue to put out audio in a podcast form for those of us that don't have time to watch YouTube. But yeah, I would never steer you away from that because you'll definitely get more exposure on it.
Oh, yeah, I think we'd absolutely, just like Tinkar. He does podcast and video. If we do go video, I don't want to stop the podcast part.
No.
I like listening to podcasts. I mean, I don't watch Tinkar almost ever. Though recently him and Glenn were talking on Dungeons and Dragons this past weekend. And they were talking about wanting to talk more about discussion with a guest. And I was almost going to try to invite myself again like we did last time. I'd love to chat them up about DMing on their podcast. So Glenn or Eric, if you're listening, give us a holler. We'd love to come back on. We need to have Eric on, but he's probably too busy with being the superstar
every day.
Superstar of the OSR, man. But yeah, don't worry, Jason. We ain't giving up podcasting for YouTubing. No way.
No, most of the methods of doing it offer the audio.
Yeah.
You can export the audio out as a separate thing. So
simulcast, baby.
Right. So it's no reason why we can't do it. If anything, I was mentioning to Randy before we started that I would put clips out.
Yeah.
Until we get to where we can use some method of well, we can do it now. It's just not ideal the way we have it set up.
Right. We're just getting our feet under us, the whole podcasting anyway.
Right.
Are we done?
We are done.
Oh, okay.
Not with the whole podcast, but
with Jason. Okay, cool. Well, he laid it on us this week, didn't he?
He did. So all right. I don't know what the accurate count of those is, because he had some repeating numbers and he had some missing numbers. So
he set a record, but I'm going to say, well done, sir. Well done.
Yes, well done. Thank you very much, Jason.
Yes, thank you. Because you got any other goodness in the positive material plane for us, my brother? I got a couple things I wanted to mention.
Well, you go ahead.
Well, one thing I was thinking about, and I'm trying to think about the positive material plane in this segment. One thing about our hobby that I really like is it lends itself to both active and passive playing. And what I mean by that, active, obviously, you're sitting around with your buddies, you're playing D&D or online, whatever. But you can, in some games, even back in old D&D first edition, our buddy Philip used to talk about I've made hundreds of characters. He would make characters. And I remember you talking about making characters. Mm-hmm. And so you have a play you can have in third edition. It's really great because you can have the build game where you can build all these. I'm going to build 5 10th level wizards, and they're all going to be completely different. And you could do that. And that was a fun sort of lonely play, right? But it's kind of passive.
I've never heard it called lonely play.
Yeah, because and for me, when I'm prepping a game, and I've only seen this in the last few years within myself, I can't tell you how much I enjoy prepping the game. It is thoroughly enjoyable for me. Now, when I hit a block, it's a little frustrating. But as I'm thinking about it and I'm writing things down, I just love the crap out of it. It's a creative part that is in many ways passive because we're not playing. I'm just building to play.
Right.
And to me, I think that's a great thing about our hobby. I guess other hobbies could do that too. I mean, I'm trying to think if you're a big basketball guy, and we love to play basketball for years, but if you're way into it and you play intramural and, you know, you're not professional, but you play a lot, I mean, you probably go out and, you know, buy shoes. You might watch videos on how to improve your jump shot. You might go out and shoot 100 free throws a day if you're a Steve Alford from IU, you know, but he was professional eventually. So I don't know. I mean, I guess there's elements of that in the hobby too, right? Gun people that are enthusiasts for hunting probably watch hunting shows, read hunting magazines, clean their guns. Some even make, you know, they order guns and parts and make them. So right. I mean, I guess that's not unique to our hobby, but I thought it was a really cool thing that you could do that. Right.
Just to let you know, you can always tell me about prepping, whether you like it, how much you like it. You can always tell me. Never feel that you can't. We're friends.
Okay. Is it okay that I tell you?
It's okay.
You?
It's okay. Okay.
Yeah. And if you allow for collecting too, D&D is a collectible hobby now because you can collect miniatures. You can collect books. Heck, if you try to go back and buy the first edition books, good luck. That's definitely collector prices.
Yeah. Yeah. I was looking at some stuff. Somebody brought up on one of the threads, or podcast or something about Empire of the Petal Throne.
Yep.
And I went and looked at how much it costs to get one.
Yeah.
No, I'm never going to own that.
What are you talking, like $500 for a crappy version?
Well, I didn't look at the quality, but the highest one I saw was like $350.
Yeah. And, yeah, that's not happening.
No. I'd have to have money to burn.
And I think we've mentioned before, but I also, in our hobby, we are in a golden age. I really think, I'm trying to think now. For me personally, this feels like the height of role playing. When I was in the early 80s, it felt like it was, but it was kind of we were still kind of rebels because it was, you know, quote unquote, Satan's game. And there weren't as many options. But now you have role playing games for anything you can imagine, and it's not even remotely considered. I mean, we call it nerdish, but it's not, dude. It's cool to play RPGs now. And there's right. just so many options out there. To me, that's another great thing about our hobby is, you know, I think if you want to play it, it's there. You know, if you can't find something, if you're a role player and you like to play role playing games and you can't find a game you like to play, you're not trying.
No, you're not trying hard enough.
Yeah. There's
every
flavor imaginable.
Right. Every kind of game you can think of.
Yeah. And probably some I would never think of, like Monster right. Arts. Right. I try to never think of Monster Arts.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And speaking of that, I put up a link on my end of the outline, so you can't mm-hmm. see it.
Perfect.
But do I have it open still? Yeah.
Show me some.
Over at, let's see.
Where are you taking me, man? To the land that D&D forgot. Oh, crowdfunding collection number 64, Talon's RPG
number Corner. Number 164.
Hmm. Okay.
So this person has been doing it for a while, and
yeah.
I think this is not. This is English. This is in English, but it's translated to some.
Oh, okay.
I think it's a German site.
Oh.
What they do is this person. Goes and looks up at least, I don't know what kind of filters they use to find the games that are role-playing games, mm-hmm. but they do is a broad swath and of gaming. So if you don't, and this is crowdfunding, so they're not necessarily out yet.
Okay.
But if they, and I didn't look it up to see if they had it, an archive of this, so you can look up past ones that have already been fulfilled and maybe delivered and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be easy to find something.
Cool.
Know what's coming down the pike.
Archive on the left at the bottom. Near the bottom. Archive. Right after the April 2021. You see that archive?
Yeah.
AR. Yeah, so he's got one.
And you see it doesn't have an E on it. So it
probably, yeah. Translation issues.
Yeah. So, yeah. So that's cool.
Yeah.
Look that up. It's very, and you know, back in the day, we would just go to the game store
mm-hmm.
nearby. But if you're in a really small town, you may not have one.
Right. Oh, and these days, I mean, game stores, if you have them, they don't. I mean, it's just not.
It's all WotC and
mostly. I'll find some WotC cool ones. The ones we find anyway are.
And Paizo.
Yeah. Yep.
And then they have a couple of smattering of other stuff.
But. Now, what was that one in D.C. that you had? That was impressive. You had that one game store, and they had six copies of Blood Bowl. I'm right. like, dude, that's already a collectible. And well, they had they were delineated by Dungeons and Dragons and Call of Cthulhu and all these. I mean, they had it was like a library. It had like nice actual bookshelves, and that's how they stacked them. It was impressive, and a massive gaming area and food you could buy. It was the first time I had seen that kind of store. That was back in,
long time ago, 20 years ago.
'90s, yeah. But I was like impressed. That was a heck of a store.
And in Germany, when I was stationed there, you would never know it by walking by, but then again, everything's in German. So maybe right. it's just sure. me being an American, but right. I was taken to a game store there, and it was a hole in the wall,
mm-hmm.
weirdly fit in building, but it had a lot of stuff, now, all yeah. kinds of different stuff. It was a huge variety of different things. And yeah, the fellow there, he knew English and had no problem speaking English and knew it well, so it was easy to talk to him about games and stuff. So it was really great.
Yeah, when I went to Hamburg in 2015, that conference, that math conference I went to in Hamburg, I just went down the street from the college, the university, and I went into a little hole in the wall place. I bought a Batman comic in German just to have it, but he had Pathfinder, he had Dungeons and Dragons. Shadowrun, he said Shadowrun and D&D were his biggest sellers.
Mm.
And then he had a German game. I think it was Dark Eye, but it was in German. Dark Eye is now in the US too. And he was very, you know, he was very personable. He was telling me about the games that were popular there in Germany. He said it used to be D&D, but Shadowrun was big in his area. And when I was there, I didn't meet a German that couldn't speak a little English.
Right.
A lot better than I could speak, more better than I can sprechen Sie Deutsch.
I mean, you might have some folks that I'm pretty sure they all get taught English, but yeah. We've had soldiers there for who knows how long.
Yeah. I got turned around in their train system, you know, the one that goes below the ground, and I didn't know which one I was taking. I asked this lady, and she goes, I'll ask my daughter, because my English is not very good. And she said it just like that. And I'm like, and she goes, and her daughter's like, mine's not too good either, but I'll try. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Your English is probably better than my English. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was pretty cool. So, fun times.
But the train system there is awesome.
Dude, you can go anywhere you want.
Yeah. All you probably had to do was stay on the train long enough to come back to where you had started.
Yeah, but I got news for you.
Big while.
You're going to catch a train in Germany? You better be on time. Because the Germans, they ain't playing.
They
say we're leaving at 3:15, and you get there at 3:16, you're busting not on that train.
Nope.
They don't play.
No.
Yeah.
Lots of variety and not hard to get to.
You don't necessarily have that
game store down the road to get the newest game. You just go online. It's easy.
I don't know if your microphone's too far from your mouth, but it sounds like you're a little far away. That's okay.
Is this better?
That's much better.
Much better. Right. Yeah. So, the bad thing, though, is when you search things out online and you go to some websites, they can feature stuff that you might not like, stuff that I won't like.
Yeah, for sure. You and I are pretty picky with stuff like that.
We're picky. So you have to sift through, and it can be difficult. But now I think I'm getting a better handle on being able to figure out how to circumnavigate without being bothered. It doesn't seem at this point as bad as it did maybe 6 months to a year ago. It seemed like
everywhere
every
you turn,
company wanted to, you know, to you know, they were full of leftists and we didn't
pushing
like their direction, which they can do what they want.
But
at this point, I think it's a lot easier to find the good stuff.
And it's there, and stuff is there. To me, that's the big point I'm trying to make. When I was younger, if I couldn't make it a trip to the game store in Clarksville, let's say, if I couldn't make it there, it was called Something to Do. They had some board games and Talisman. They had Dungeons and Dragons, and you might see a Palladium book, and you might see Call of Cthulhu. You know, you might. But it's all mostly TSR stuff.
Right. So now all you have to do is type in OSR.
Boom. A billion things.
Then you just avoid all the nonsense.
Dude, you sound like you're about converted. I tell you, I am.
I'm definitely ready. Use the material. I mean, I may not want to use Vancey and Magic in my game at my table.
Who does, really?
I mean, as a player, I don't get the choice, but if I'm running the game, I don't necessarily need to have it there. And there's a lot of ways to get around it.
Well, we already talked about one tonight, Jason. Reminded me of another one.
Sure. And there's plenty of setting material and other goodies you can find in the OSR, and it's a friendly group. So
yeah. Okay. Shall we go on to the main topic?
Main topic: gaming inspiration. Both direct and indirect. I have to say, since we're going to start with movies, a lot of movies that aren't gaming movies kind of, I don't know if it's direct inspiration or more mindset or any of that, but a lot of movies that we watched when we were younger, Blazing Saddles.
Yeah.
Or Airplane.
Right.
Or the good, the bad, and the ugly. Lots of those kinds of movies, to me, that are from our era, maybe they don't inspire fantasy archetypes.
Right.
But other types of archetypes, heroic.
Sure.
Or
how to have a good villain.
Yeah, have a good villain, or just how to be funny. Sometimes a lot of comedy movies, especially Mel Brooks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, dude. Remember, we used to talk a lot about History of the World Part 1. That was kind of our favorite, you know, Mel Brooks book movie back in the day. Of course, a lot of these are ones that you couldn't play today on TV because people get their feelings hurt. But absolutely, they do. I think they inspire you. I think when you watch any kind of movie that has adventure. Now, I'll tell you something. Movies that I get intrigued by that don't have anything to do with you know, you can imagine the setting would be something like It's a Wonderful Life, where the main character is visited by an angel to guide him and show him how good his life is. The idea of it says, oh, wow, you could have the character contacted by a supernatural force to tell them something they need to do or to show them that they're on the right path. I mean, you can kind of out of the blue, because they've been doing the right thing, a group of adventurers and plugging along. They're trying to destroy the Eye of Vecna, and they've got it, and they've had no luck, and they're currently holed up in a cave because they're being hunted down by, you know, some undead high level lich type dude, and they're about ready to give up because they know all they got to do is just say, let's just hide it here, it's good enough. Then you can have their god have an angel say, no, you're on the right path, you're so close to the mountain of doom, to Mount Doom, all you must do is throw the eye in there, trust me, and then show a path through the woods that will get them there quick. I mean, I think that kind of stuff, believe it or not, it seems silly, but something as simple as It's a Wonderful Life can inspire you, like, you know, a supernatural ally who doesn't do everything for you, just shows you a path. I mean, that's one that I've thought of that definitely is not D&D, not fantasy, but not traditional fantasy, sword and sorcery fantasy.
Right. It's a fantastic story, but it still presents a different take on the hero's journey.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think movies that don't connect directly, you know, if I'm watching Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and I did that recently, and a few other ones, what's that trilogy called? There's a trilogy. The Good, the Bad,
A Fistful of Dollars for a Few Dollars More, and Good, Bad, and the Ugly are all.
Yeah. It got me ready for our Deadlands game. We were running there for a while, and it got me in the mood. I watched how people talk to each other. I saw commonalities between the film. And there's this one scene where this young boy, there's a donkey that's attached to a well, and he's moving around. I'm trying to remember what he was. Maybe he was used to, maybe not to a well, to a wheel, and he's grinding something for them. They use a donkey, and this young boy is riding as goes along. And I'm like, okay, so that's what a farm might look like out in, you know, the middle of nowhere, Kansas or wherever. And right. So it just inspires me it gives me imagery. And when you come to a town, I noticed that the town seemed to have, and it might've just been Hollywood, had this same look to them. They got the saloon, and there's a straight shot right down Main Street. And you have the sheriff's office, and you have the barber who doubles as the undertaker. And you have, you know, the saloon, and you have this and that, and the church, and church is at the end usually, and there's a well somewhere. And it's like, that's kind of standard. Every town you go into in those old Westerns, they look very similar. And so to me, it just gives you a lot of archetypes and tropes to run with in a genre type game. Even if it's not, and I was purposely taking notes, but even if you weren't, you can be relaxing. That stuff can feed you. Like I'm going to try to watch the first two Aliens again before we go to Cabin Con, because I want to get in that mindset of Aliens that I'm running.
Right. Another good spaghetti Western. It's a little on the fantasy side.
Mm-hmm.
Is My Name Is Nobody.
Hmm. I don't think I've seen that one.
Right. And I'm trying to remember the name of the actor, but essentially you have this fellow who's kind of real lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And when you first come into the movie, he's riding, he has his horse pulling him on a stretcher.
Oh, okay.
He's sleeping.
Oh, okay.
He's just letting his horse go wherever. And he's got his hat over his head, and and he's just letting his horse pull him. And the horse goes right up to the either to the well or to the hitching post and stops. And then he's like, oh, he stopped. And then he gets out and goes into, because they stopped at a kind of a tavern, and he goes in and gets something to eat. But I'm pretty sure it's called My Name Is Nobody. And he and this other fellow are in all these movies. There's two or three of them.
Yeah.
And I think his character's name is Trinity.
Yes, I've heard of this.
Right. And he's really fast.
Is he a blonde dude?
Blonde dude.
Okay. I've seen an excerpt from that, though.
He's an expert with his gun. He's really fast. He's great at hand-to-hand fighting. He doesn't seem smart, mm-hmm. but he always figures out what's going on.
Right.
So, and it's just a fun story.
Right. And to me, I think, like in Deadlands, they should be fun. Those games, they can be dark, but it's a lot of, I feel like there's a little bit of tongue-in-cheek in Deadlands. There's definitely some spaghetti Western feels, and then there's zombies. So, but yeah, for sure, I think movies definitely take us there. I mean, Terminator gets me ready for some hard, you know, hard sci-fi action. Aliens does. For D&D, though, I mean, I don't necessarily watch fantasy. I see it in other stuff. There's not lots of great Lord of the Rings, obviously. I mean, that's a must. That gives you the perfect adventuring party and the setup. Right.
I mean, some folks want to go back into the 80s. For the fantasy movies there, but
the camp
you got Conan, but
yeah.
Conan and Willow.
Yeah.
Is there something else that I'm not thinking of?
Honestly, Conan the Destroyer, I think, is kind of a poop movie, but it's really a standard D&D party. It's a very D&D type movie.
Right, right. Jason, yeah. The one we just heard in
Nerds RPG.
Messages, he speaks very highly of Conan the Destroyer.
As, I think he's got a point.
Yeah. I don't like the movie, but I understand where he's coming from.
The movie is really kind of cheeseballish, but it shows – it definitely is good. I mean, when I was watching, I was like, this is more D&D than the first Conan.
Right, right.
It plays more like D&D. So, right. Yeah, but I wouldn't call it good. But I think movies inspire us. They give us that visual medium. You see it, and I think movies make such a – we'll borrow the old phrase we used before – an imprint in your mind, cool mm-hmm. movies, mm-hmm. that you can remember them and call them. Heck, my wife. You know, my wife, if I describe an NPC, she'd be like, that sounds like – you're saying he looks a little bit like Bruce Willis? And if I say he looks like Bruce Willis, she can remember him.
Right.
Is this
right.
the Bruce Willis guy? And I'm like, yeah. Oh, okay. I liked him.
Right.
You know? And so I think a lot of times I've done that. I'm like, yeah, he looks like, you know, James Spader or whatever. So, yeah.
Right. So movies are awesome. Books, I can go way far back because I'm old.
Oh, there's all kinds of good books.
For fantasy and sci-fi books are especially early on, like in the 70s, they were kind of a crapshoot. It was either some kind of there was overly sexualized story
weirdness.
That
just weirdness.
Just lots. Well, weird is okay, but you know there was I can't remember the name of the story, but it was about these explorers who went to another planet and mm-hmm. they landed there and they were trying to figure things out and these birds or bird-like creatures landed near them. And they opened up their wings and spewed them all with this crap. And it was, you know, whatever it was. And then it was, they all started, you know, they tore off their clothes and got busy. I mean, absolutely had no control of themselves. And I'm like, is this what this story is about? I'm putting it back on the shelf.
I want to say Jack Vance's, is it Dying World?
Dying Earth.
Dying Earth. I read one of those books and I pushed my way through it. And it wasn't bad, but, you know, which were, you know, like, for example, in the book I read, I don't remember the name of it. Maybe some listeners can tell me where he mentions the prismatic sphere spell, the prismatic, they call it the prismatic spray spell or one of those. And I thought, oh, and I could see where Gygax got some of his ideas, but everything was just so just weird. I mean, it was like everything was super alien. Back in the 70s, they seemed like they wanted to mix sorcery and sci-fi. Maybe they took the Clark Ashton Smith's statement that any technology significantly advanced will seem like magic.
Right.
And that's actually where I got your Bush's idea of being a VAT boy, VAT. There was a guy in there that could create people.
Right.
And I was like, oh, that'll be the guy that created Butch. So there you go. I was inspired by that book. I was like, that's really creepy and weird. Cause when you made that character, all you told me is he remembered coming into this tavern and that was it. And right. Joe just left it completely open. He said, Randy, do whatever you want with Butch. And so I decided was created as that. Came out, sixth level fighter. That was pretty cool.
Walking and talking.
And how about Dresden, dude? I think Dresden
there's a lot of stuff in there.
There's always a good mystery. There's always a way to see how there can be main villains, and then there can be people you have to deal with who aren't necessarily good, but they'll deal with you. And prices that you have to pay sometimes. You got to be careful how you deal with powerful entities in that game or in that book series. And so I think that's, I always like that, especially with my fandom of Planescape, you know, the idea that you got to be careful how you walk sometimes, you know. And to me, it reminds me, even high level characters need to know that they're not necessarily the baddest thing walking in all the multiverse.
Yeah, because Dresden certainly is not the most powerful entity in the novels.
But
there's plenty that are more powerful.
As far as earthly people, he is super BA.
Yeah.
But you're right. He has to be careful when he deals with Mab, which is a Fey Queen, and he has to be careful when he deals with, who's the Santa Claus? Is the other Saint? Well, what do they call him? He's actually Santa Claus.
I can't remember now.
And he's a Fey dude.
Put me on the spot.
And he's like, he didn't like Dresden there for a while,
right.
But he said, I have to show him Saint Nick some respect because he was like uber powerful.
Oh, yeah. He's Odin.
That's right. He was Odin.
He's Odin.
Yeah, yeah. Spoiler alert, if you're reading the Dresden series.
Oops.
I'm down two books. Have you read the last two?
Sorry, Jason.
I haven't read the last two. Have you, Joe? Have you read the last two books that were?
Yes, I have.
Oh, I'm behind. I got to read them. I got them sitting on
the shelf. They're up
there. Did you like them? Thumbs up?
Yeah,
thumbs down?
They're good.
Okay, good.
Well,
okay.
Yeah. Dresden's kind of gonzo in a way because he employs the full spectrum of creatures of myth.
Yes, he does.
Which can be good and bad. As far as urban fantasy goes, I'm really tired of that.
Yeah.
Every urban fantasy that comes out, they have to deal with all the monsters. They can't just... you know, be, you know, cool and have one or two. All right. The monsters have to be there.
Gotcha. It can't get old.
Right.
Yeah. But what about the D&D books? Now, Jason mentioned this in his call.
They were crap.
Right. And I was thinking he agreed with you perfectly. But
to be honest, I didn't read them all. I read a few.
Me too.
I tried reading here and there, but I didn't like them. I read Gord the Rogue.
Yep.
It was fairly weak. Yeah. I think I read it more out of just brand loyalty than anything.
Yep, me too.
But after that, I was like, well, I'm really going to be picky with this stuff.
I thought a really good one was it Jander, Sunstar, and Strahd? Was it Istrahd? I don't think so. And I read Knight of the Black Rose, where Soth goes to Ravenloft and gets stuck there. I thought that was pretty cool. I think at best they seem like dramatized modules on paper. And the ones I've read, I've enjoyed. Our buddy Philip loves them. He's read a buttload of them.
Yeah.
And I think they have some, they're definitely good for direct to D&D ideas. I mean, you could definitely just completely steal a concept if you wanted to and tell an adventure like that. So
right.
For D&D, they can be good. But reading, so if you were comparing reading and movies, there's a difference though, right?
Well, yeah, different mediums have different advantages. Books, they you can get really deep into character development and what's on a character's mind, because they tell you in the book often.
Yep.
But in a movie, unless you do the Dune movie from back in the 70s where every character had a voiceover,
right?
You know, you don't know necessarily what's on their mind very much.
And don't you think? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So there are a couple of dimensions that you don't get. Movies are limited medium. Okay. So I guess books, you have to rely on someone who's imaginative and can read and visualize things and all that. In a movie, you can tell a lot of stuff with camera work and characters' reactions to things. They don't have to even say. See, I think there's a scene from Avengers 2 that we both talk about being a very key scene where is it Bobby?
Bobby.
The flame guy in Avengers, not Avengers 2, X-Men 2.
Pyro.
Pyro. So he goes to the Iceman's home. They're both teenagers, and he sees all the pictures.
Spoilers.
sorry, Jason. He sees pictures of a nice family, and he comes from a broken home, and it makes him angry.
Yes.
Instead of what a normal person would say, oh, that's nice.
Or you would think, dude, why don't you appreciate what Xavier's going to try to do for you? He's trying to give you as normal family as you can have.
Yeah, he was looking at what Xavier was trying to give him.
Right.
And he went the opposite way. And but you could see the emotions playing over the characters' eyes. They had some music in the background, and the camera was working between the picture and the character, the pictures that the character was looking at.
It all expresses a thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And so
it's hard to do a lot of that. You have to be really good.
Well, yeah, well, that's why there's good movies and bad ones. Right. What about this? How about movies leave a visual imprint? Well, I think books give you great detail. I think books are more will inspire me more to, like, dude, I'd like to have a clan of warriors like that in my world. Man, I'd like to have a race of creatures that the players could play that are like the green Martians in John Carter of Mars. Right. I like the culture there. It's really cool, and it'd be a neat group where they could play one of those. So I'm going to port that idea over into the and make my creatures that live here, my people that live here, they're going to be that race, and they're going to be like that. That's harder to get that from a movie.
Right.
It's harder.
While you can it shows you a visual of the creature in the book, there's usually a lot more explained in the culture and everything that you can grab more onto.
Yeah, true. What about comic books now? I'll line that up next.
Yeah, comic books, I'm not as big into them and haven't been over my life as you have. There's been a few, like Captain America and Daredevil for a while. I read Punisher a bit. And
Spider-Man for a short
Spider-Man. I tried to get all of the titles, but that came to be very tedious because he had what, 7 at one time.
Dude, they've had some
bunch of Spider-Man titles, and there were different artists for the different Spider-Man, so they looked a little different too.
Yeah, and different writers, so the stories are different quality. I really didn't know. I'm a pretty big comic collector, but I think comics always jived with me. I think comics bring back a nostalgia that D&D does for me too these days, because I was such a collector. But I think in terms of stories, I think they have their pages are very splashy. So you'll see cool poses, and those poses where they're sort of like a visual imprint with movies, but there's something else. You get a little reading, you get a look into the minds. I almost feel like comic books inspire me somewhere between movies and books.
Yeah, a little bit like that. Sometimes you get weird stuff like he's got metal on his metal doesn't do that.
Yeah. Can Colossus eat when he's in metal form? Are his organs metallic inside? Does he poop? You wonder if something like that whenever he does that. So yeah.
Like, yeah, but there were some weird I read a lot of Iron Man too, and sometimes you're like, he's wearing metal. And there's weird, like it flexes his the muscles. And I'm like,
yeah,
metal doesn't do that.
No, he must have some kind of super.
I mean, special metal. I think there was some at one point in the movies that it shows that the metal does form fit a bit in certain areas. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure how much that was in the comic book, especially early on.
I do think comics informs my preference for play style. Because I like superheroes. You know, if it's Superman or Lex Luthor, it's Superman. If it's Batman or the Joker, I'm sorry, folks, it's the Bat. If it's Batman or Harley Quinn, it's the Bat. I'm not about the villains. I am not. I'm about the heroes. And I read comics for superhero stuff. And I think when I do that, and I come to the game table, you, Joe and I are like mine. We're playing heroes, dude.
Right.
We're not the villains. We aren't killing people. We're not raping and pillaging. You know, we're kicking the crap out of the bad guys. And that's what I want to do. And you see that you used to see that a lot more in comics. And I think that's where I get my inspiration for why I like the heroes at my table. I don't like dark, evil characters.
No. And even Batman, as much as they call him the Dark Knight.
Superheroic. Come on.
Yeah.
I mean, he earns the title superhero. I mean, the man has got a code. You wouldn't believe it, you know, and I know they've been broken different times, but he used to be known for not killing. He wouldn't kill anybody. In the movies, they've broken it. But he was he had a strict code.
I heard in the early days he carried a gun, though.
He was drawn with a gun. He was drawn with a gun. I don't think he ever used it, but I'm not sure. But that quickly disappeared. You got to realize every hero has gone through lots of iterations. Yeah. I learned today. Yeah. You ever watch the show Comic Book Men?
No, you told me about it.
I'm on season 6 through Netflix. No, through Prime. It's on Amazon Prime. You should watch it. And it's enjoyable. It gets a little old. The cast, sometimes you can tell they're coming into their, we think we're kind of, they don't, not that I think they think they're movie stars, but they're kind of getting a little bit into their own fame, you know. But having said that, it's about a, you know, local comic store that Kevin Smith owns, him and Jason Mewes, you know, Silent Bob and whatever. And Jay, so anyway, Jane Silent Bob. Anyway, and today in this episode, they went to this museum in Baltimore, this guy who owns Diamond Comics, which used to be the only distributor of comics. And this guy has a museum. And you talk about of pop culture. And in one area, he had comic books. Joe, he had Submariner 1. He had Doctor Strange 1. He had these books that were, and he had Action Comics 1.
Wow.
In a glass case. And I was like, just blown away. Just that feeling of, wow, this is unbelievable. And I think I've lost where I was going with this point. What was I leading to?
Comic,
I
guess, book to me, man. Comic book,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, comic man. So my point is, I think they inspire me gaming wise too, because they always talk about heroism, right, how it's great to be around. And then they joke, and some say, but the main guy, Walt, who runs the store for Kevin, he is all about the hero. And he said it just like what I said. And then I was like, you know, I'm all about the hero. I'm not about, I don't want you coming to my table and planning on being the Joker and taking over the, or destroying the world. That's, right. I mean, look, you can do that at your table if you want to. And I get some boasts like evil campaigns. I really don't.
No.
I mean, I've tried to run them. I just find it distasteful.
Because it's always, I don't know. If you run through modules, like a lot of people do, let's just do the module. Module. And you have a bunch of evil guys in your group.
Mm-hmm.
You just run the module. Big deal. So what? You're evil. I don't care. You're just running the module.
I mean, unless what you're going to do, unless what you're going to do is run the module and then try to screw what the GM's doing.
Right.
Don't mean you, the DM runs the module, but you're not playing it.
Right.
You catch my drift?
Right.
Okay, you need to go save this town. No, we're going to help the temple. We're going to join the Temple of Elemental Evil, and we're going to take over Greyhawk.
Right. Now, depending on how things go, that might make an interesting story, perhaps.
It might.
But
would you want to play an evil wizard joining with the temple?
No, I think if I was going to do something like that, it would be just a one-shot thing. Diversions. But
yeah, when, okay.
Yeah.
I could be with a diversion, like a cabin con adventure.
Right.
It's not something I'd want to keep. I don't know. I just think
I wouldn't want a campaign like that.
Maybe someone at Cabin Con would run an evil campaign where we just played at Cabin Con, one adventure. And maybe we could like that. Maybe it's called Spoil This Module. And he'd run different modules and we could turn on his ear. I don't know. Maybe I'll do that. No.
Right. No, you won't do that.
No, I won't. No.
But yeah, there was something I was going to say about comics. Now I've lost it.
That you wish you could, you had all the comics I had. You look at my collection and salivate with envy.
Well, I was going to say Namor. Namor.
Mm.
Okay, no to your thing.
No.
I don't want that. I don't mind reading them, but I'm not a collector.
I know you're not.
I've always thought Namor was a more interesting character than Aquaman.
Fair. Very fair.
He had a weird set of abilities,
mm-hmm.
but at least they were useful.
And he was honorable. He was not always a good guy.
No.
Because he didn't care much for the air breathers. They get on his nerves. I mean, he had a thing for Sue Richards, but he was not... Sometimes he was friends with the good guys. Sometimes he was fighting Black Panther. So, I mean, it depends on what time of day it is.
Right.
It wasn't chaotic. He just, you know, if it was like, that's against what Atlantis is about, sorry. And,
right.
and when he was in the water, he was no joke. Submariner, even outside of the water, he was pretty tough.
Yeah, he could fly.
He could fly.
He's super strong.
Oh, yeah, super strong. Throw cars through buildings. Yeah, he was not. I mean, he was stronger than Spider-Man.
Right, and he was fairly invulnerable, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he was a smart dude. Namor is brilliant.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he was dangerous.
And
dangerous.
I mean, talking to the fish, I'm sorry, is not that great.
But to be fair, okay, I'll play that other side. Aquaman is strong as an ox. Mm-hmm. Aquaman has no issue with being outside of the water for too long.
So right, Namor needs Namor needs the water.
And Aquaman's as strong or stronger than Submariner. No doubt.
Right.
So Aquaman gets the short shift because of talking to the animals and the Justice League. Those little bubbles go out. But I mean the dude was he's a legit powerhouse now. He wasn't part of the Justice League just because, you know, he could talk to animals, see animals. He was pretty legit. If you watch the Justice League movie, Aquaman's somebody to be reckoned with now. But what about other games? I just listed a few for the heck of it. Vampire, 13th Age. I wasn't listing them as necessarily my inspiration, though I think they do. When you play another game,
Other than D&D.
we're mostly a D&D podcast. Let's be honest.
Right.
So we're RPG stuff. We're more D&D. When I play other games, I get inspired to play D&D.
Yeah.
I imagine
how D&D could do this better or different.
Yeah. Yeah. Or I imagine, wow, that's a cool mechanic. I wish D&D did that.
Yeah.
Like I really like one unique things from 13th Age.
Right.
I think, I mean, if it was up to me, we'd have them in every game. What's unique about your character?
Yeah, I'm always intrigued with the wounds from Savage Worlds because it's kind of irritating that I have 100 hit points and I'm good all the way down. Even if I just have one hit point
left. You can hit that dragon as hard as you could at one hit point as you could at 100.
Yeah, it doesn't make any difference. Right.
No. Yeah, Savage Worlds, I think, is got a cool mechanic. And even though, you know, we talk about being swingy, I think Savage Worlds really shows me, when you look at all their different settings, I get really inspired by, wow, I would never have thought to put 1776 political figures together with superheroes and make a superhero story, the Sons of Liberty or whatever it's called. If I can ever find that in hardback, I think I can get it on PDF. I think it's called Sons of Liberty. And basically, who is the guy that the British are coming? Who is that guy? Paul Revere. Paul Revere is a speedster. He's a super speedster. It's really cool, though. I mean, and they do stuff like, you know, we talked about Rippers. We talked about Deadlands, a great mix of stuff. To me, it shows me, you know, you can throw curveballs into your D&D game.
Right.
You know, like, for example, I like the idea of, I've always loved this idea. There was an article during third edition. I think they were called the Sheens, and they were a robot-like race.
Yeah.
And they had a couple of issues in Dragon where they talked about how they could, you know, a Sheen wouldn't be a ship, kind of like a ship, but more like a comet comes, lands on your planet and explodes, and a few Sheen come out, and they talk about a campaign, how they start to try to take over your whole world. You know, there's one.
A little like the Borg.
A little bit like the Borg. And even though I'm not a big fan of, you know, I don't want my science fiction chocolate dipping in my fantasy peanut butter, that's a pretty cool idea. And Savage Worlds has a campaign setting called Evernight, where you do that. You start out in a standard fantasy world, and you start getting taken over by these aliens that are very mind flayer like, and it becomes kind of a science fantasy game. And so I think if other games show you mechanically what D&D, I would say this, whatever is your main game, you should play other games because you might see mechanics you can port over, or you might see just styles of play, like narrative control. We never really talked about that until we played 13th Age.
Correct. I think we were behind the eight ball on that one. You know, behind the times.
Oh, way behind the times. Yeah,
I think the narrative part of gaming got brought up probably a decade before we got, you know, involved in even thinking about it.
Right. We were classic, dude. Randy tells a story. We react to what he throws at us. That's it. Yeah. And you would never even think as a player, like, I'm in a bar, I got in a half ogre fighter, just knocked my teeth out. I reach behind the bar, I find a club, right? Yeah, you do, says the DM. You know, and that kind of stuff. I think it's really cool when you let players take some ownership of the setting, of the scene, without it being stupid. I reach behind the bar and I get a stab at the Magi, right? No, that's dumb.
Every bar has one.
Stab at the Magi, you're waiting for your wizard to grab.
Right. Mm-hmm. And, along with games, miniatures Oh, do I? I don't have it up here. I was going to show it.
Oh.
For miniatures, I think the most inspiration I've gotten from a miniature is from a WizKids miniature from their, I think it's a Mage Knight figure, the big giant with the dwarves sitting on top of it.
Yeah, that's super cool. Yeah.
It's really big, and it really, because I'm pretty sure there's the giant has tattoos. Mm-hmm. The dwarves, there's two of the dwarves that are manning crossbows, automatic crossbows. They have little magazines of bolts that go up to it.
Yep. And
there's one dwarf on top kind of steering, but he also has these sticks in his hands that could be wands.
Oh, okay.
It might be something else, but so you could take a lot of different kinds of inspiration just from looking at the different parts. This is a really big and detailed figure.
Mm-hmm.
I think I built a couple of different adventures around using it.
Oh yeah, I remember early on in early D&D, one of the first minis I got, and you'll testify to this. I'm talking our early days. You go Greenwich Village, Sea of Fire Adventures, Randy's First Stab. One of the first minis I bought, first couple, was Orcus and Asmodeus.
Right.
I bought those old medals. Yeah. And remember, you turn a corner, and I had a rule. If you said the demon's name or the devil's name out loud, whether you said it as a player or you said it as a character, I rolled a 5% chance they'd show up.
Right.
And I remember watching. Oh, I wanted to use them so bad. Yeah. And so that's all I could think of. Like, they're only third level. I can't just have them go to the Nine Hells and meet Asmodeus. So if they say his name, I'm pulling him up. It's like, yeah, that'd be great. Good adventure, roll initiative. This will be great.
Of course, if you want to just grease the whole party, I'll make it 30% just in case.
Right. Or I'll just lie and say, yeah, I rolled it. No, I don't think I did that. But yeah, I think the Colossal Red, oh my goodness, that inspired me in the Seven Spheres game we played to make that. Remember that dragon? Mm-hmm, I won't go into details. We've talked about it before. This crazy dragon I spent 4 hours. I just looked at it and said, can you imagine? And my wife actually came by and said, I can't imagine ever fighting that. She goes, she took four little figures. Can you imagine four little figures fighting this? And the very next night we did that. And she goes, that was so unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
She loved it, but she's like, I really can't see that being a fight. And so, yeah, it was very, very, very inspiring.
Well, you can also take that gargantuan figure or colossal.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine the world around it, because a creature of that magnitude with the kind of power it would have would probably rule a planet.
Dude, to Matt, yeah. I mean, when you look at its stats, I'm remembering correctly.
Is this a Dark Lord? It's the same thing as a Dark Lord.
Dude, yeah. I mean, he's a dragon. He's a super genius intelligence. He's a 20th level wizard and a 20th level cleric. I think that was the stats. I may be wrong. And I'm like, you're right. He would rule, if not a whole world, at least a continent. And he's a red dragon, but red dragons are a lot about destruction. So maybe, but you know, you could say this. He can only eat so much. And his body requires so much fuel that he does have to rest more. So maybe he would have to have places where he would hide. And being greedy dragons, they don't want to share their loot with anybody, so they want to hide it. I mean, this is just justification you can make for him not coming out and saying, I'm going to dominate. But I would imagine, as smart as he is, he would be, even if he wasn't the guy you see sitting on the emperor's throne, he is the power behind the throne.
Oh, yeah, because he would have lackeys. I mean, like, imagine like Dracula.
Yeah.
He had folks do things for him, or he would pull strings. He had to sleep every day, all day, every day. He could, well, depending on which version of Dracula you're talking about, but he did have to rest. And but he did some long range planning. Some kind of eternal being would do stuff like that. So the dragon, a dragon like that, might have periods where it would have to sleep for a long time. What's that?
Right.
When a animal
hibernate.
You'd have to hibernate for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't tell me a colossal amount of resources it would take just to keep him going.
Oh yeah.
He's not just a physical being. He's a mental being. He has all that magic. All that all takes energy.
Dude. And if he was out in the open all the time, he'd be like, look, you guys need to have every elephant that you have in this continent in a stable so I can eat whenever I want, have some popcorn.
Yeah.
And then I got to have meals, and I got to have a virgin or two every now and again, just to keep up, you know, appearances. And so, you know,
right.
And Joe, you'll be thrilled. I'm inspired by another figure that I have, which is a recent collection of the Hand and Eye of Vecna. So that's very inspirational.
I can't wait for us to cut off our hands and eyes. That'll be awesome.
And my new Orcus figure. So those have to make an appearance at the table at some point in the near future. So, yeah, just miniatures alone can inspire you. They can inspire adventures. I mean, you can think of a campaign. You know, oh, my God, imagine a campaign to defeat this colossal red dragon and then just start mapping it out. Absolutely. Speaking of that, mapping it out. Ooh, get maps. That?
Oh. Now,
I got to pay a nod to Red Dice. Did you listen to Red Dice's? They have two podcasts. Their last two was on maps.
I listened to the first one. The second one, they made a I started listening to it, but it seems like it would be better to watch.
Oh, okay. So, because doesn't Hannah have some maps she wants to show
off?
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
They're always referring to the video, so I'm going to try to find time to watch the video.
I mean, I've already talked about my great love for the Greyhawk map, and so those can definitely, you can look and go, man, what is in the dim forest? So I go read the Gazetteer, they give me a couple of paragraphs, and then all of a sudden I just expand upon that, and I know what's in there and what's going on. But some of the most inspiring maps I have are my old Planescape maps, because they were not like, because you don't give a map. So here's the map of the plane of Carceri. What are you going to do? You're going to lay it all out like Greyhawk? No. So what they do instead is they kind of draw it in sort of isometric views, and they give you just kind of all these really cool artistic interpretations. You know, a map that's more art than it is meant to be used to travel around the plane. And then within the booklets, they describe what the plane's like. And to me, just looking at a map of, say, Bytopia, or one I really like is the Beastlands. There's these three different levels. There's one of day, one of night, and then one of eternal twilight. And I just think, oh, you could do all sorts of crazy stuff. In fact, when I ran that fifth edition one shot for Philip a few weeks ago or last month, I was inspired to run that adventure, and they adventured in the twilight realm of the Beastlands, which was pretty cool. So, yeah, I think maps are good both for like tactical, how far away is this, what's at this place, and when they're done more artistic, like, I think they tend to inspire stories. They do for me anyway. Have you been inspired by maps or anything?
Oh yeah, I think of all the old fantasy novels that have maps in them, and I think some of the most useful parts of modules are the maps, especially of the overland maps.
Yes.
And it's more from what you said. It's just what is there? What is in this spot that you're looking at? It has a weird name or
the name alone.
Terrain feature.
Mm-hmm. Like, I remember, even though it's funny sounding, the gnarly woods.
Right.
I remember when I saw that in Greyhawk, I was like, oh, so are the trees like all gnarled and warped because of some dark magic that was done years ago? You know, I don't think that's what was intended, but to me, that's what I thought of it as.
Right.
You know, yeah.
Or the dim forest.
Yeah.
Sunlight does not penetrate.
Correct. It doesn't penetrate. It's always dim. Mm-hmm. And they talk about them. It leads to the Valley of the Mage, and he has this race of elves that serve him, and they're the Valley Elves and Valley Girls. They were called Valley Elves, and they weren't like other elves. Other elves didn't really like them. They were tall, like 6 feet. You know, in OD&D, that was a weird elf. That was a Tolkien elf, but it was weird for other elves to be tall. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, the not playing.
Yeah.
So, the talking.
Yeah, we can thinking. Put that together.
Yeah.
We can talk about the talking and the thinking and not playing. I think sometimes when right now, we're kind of at the not playing stage.
Right.
But a lot of it's because I'm gearing up. I like to take about a month off before Cabin Con to gear up. It gets me excited so that when I'm there, I'm ready to roll. You know, my juices are just like really flowing. When I don't play, it's almost like this buildup of excitement. You know, I'm going to get to play again. And then it's like, boom, you know, and it tends to make me more adamant. It makes me more, what's the word, into it at the table. Right. I'm more inclined to do voices. I'm going to get very excited. I'm going to stand up. I'm going to do more things to make it feel like it's, you know, exciting. And so to me, I think that's what, when I'm not playing, it's just the meter's rising for me. I don't,
sure.
You're probably pretty more even keel, but I tend to just, my meter rises and rises and rises. And I can't wait until, you know, it's almost like before you're going to play a football game, back when we played football in middle school and stuff like that. It was like, I would get that kind of nervous energy before you get up there and had the kickoff, and then you're like, yeah, let's knock somebody's face in the ground, you know?
So yeah, for me, Cabin Con is more of a getting away from the rat race, so it's more of a relax.
Vacay.
Slide into the game and just enjoy the whole thing.
It's not the
excitement. It's more it's more relaxing.
I'm probably more excited the first day, and then that wears off, and then I go to your place. I'm like the mode place. Dude, we're just, you know, because we're back, our home away from home. It's like, dude, it's time to play. And I think all the discussions and that we have, like here on the podcast, has helped me. That helps me get some of my desire to play taken care of. It levels me off so that I'm not just agitated that I'm not playing, because I know on Wednesdays I could sit down with you, we get to chat about the game, and just our discussion alone, I'm constant. I got pages of 3 or 4 pages of notes I've made just from our podcast. Do I need to try this? Joe said this was cool. I agree with him. I should try this, you know.
Well, that's most of your notes.
Yeah, Joe said it's cool, I write it down, because that means it's cool.
Well, I'm so even keeled. I feel bad for my wife sometimes, because she'll be real excited about something. I say, that's cool. And she's like, right. I was so excited about that. I'm like, yeah, it's cool.
Good. She wants you to do a cartwheel or something.
It's so awesome.
And to be fair, I'm like that too. I'm like, Joe, this happened. He's like, oh, okay, yeah, I like that. I'm like, dude, do a freaking somersault right now. Yeah, so I feel Jenny's pain.
Yeah.
Browsing the internet. Listen to podcasts. Watching videos. Watching other people discuss stuff.
It can be very inspiring.
I think so. Did you notice the first one there? And I did that for a pause here. I mean, I love the red dice. The monsters though they talk about really inspire me to try new things. Mm-hmm. And as I said before, you inspire me with your comments on the podcast. But have you listened? This is a weird situation. Frankenstein's RPG. I believe Jason, when he called in once, Connolly, told us to listen to that, or I heard him mention that on a different podcast. And they got 4 episodes down. I've listened to 3. And I called him in like halfway through the 3rd one. And I told him, I said, you know, this is a podcast that I really enjoy, and I mostly don't agree with anything you guys are saying. and it's because of preferences. They're they're discussing what they're doing, Joe, is they're building a Frankenstein game. There's 3 or 4 people, and they're talking. Okay, today we're going to talk about magic systems and initiative. And each person talks about a couple of games, and they pick one they think would make a great magic system. You know, I like Vampire's magic system, or I like D&D 1E's magic system. Another person goes, I like Call of Cthulhu. Their magic system is better. I like RuneQuest. It's better. And then at the end, the host has them, after they, all, them and the host, all 4 of them, or 3 or 4 of them, they pick their favorite. Then they each vote for one of those 4 favorites, but you can't vote for your own.
Ah, okay.
And the one that gets the most vote, and I think the host decides, becomes the magic system they're going to use in their Frankenstein RPG.
Ah.
They're going to make a game. And they've done initiative, they've done combat systems, they've done skills, they've done social situations. They're doing all these different pieces of, mechanics so far to build this Frankenstein. And it got me thinking. And when I called him in, I was like, yeah, I don't agree with most of the games you guys like, but I'd like to hear your discussion. And it can be sometimes a little in-jokey where I'm not laughing because I don't get it. And they're mostly either Brits or people from Europe. But I think they really bring a lot of good ideas to this concept that you and I have been wrestling with, building a version of D&D. And it got me thinking, what I really want to do, and I may have said this last time, is I want to start with basic D&D. OD&D and build on it. Pull this from 3rd, pull this from 4th. Well, throw that back, it's 4th. Pull this in 13th age, pull this from 5e, pull this, and let's build our own Frankenstein.
Sure.
And see what happens, you know?
From the various iterations of the
game. Yeah. And the reason I say OD&D, I mean, or basic, is because it has the least amount of rules. Right. And start with that and go, okay, and you know, let's just pick the 4 basic classes. And so this really, you can tell it inspired me. And I'm like, that's kind of where I want to begin. I don't want to try to go whole hog on my own. I just want to say, I like this game. And probably reading the white box, Swords and Wizardry white box recently, multiple times, has got me thinking, I really like the base, the simplicity of this game, even though it has all the feelings. And I'll look every time, D6 damage for all the weapons. That's dumb. That's kind of dumb. But I do see a lot of things. I can just pull that out, put this in. I'm going to let somebody, like I thought, I'm going to run the movement. I read the movement multiple times. I hate the way they do movement in the Swords and Wizardry blocks. It's just,
oh yeah,
it's like you can attack or you can move. You can't do both. On the tabletop, I'm probably going to do move 6 and attack in Cabin Con just because I like that. I like 30-foot movement and attack. One action, go. Move and attack. That's a really simplistic base to start from. Anyway, so I just wanted to mention that particular podcast. Have you had any that you've listened to recently that have inspired you besides, obviously, me?
Well, there's no comparison. Let's see. All the stuff that we normally list on our podcast at the end are the ones that I listen to the most.
Sure.
But I've added a couple of YouTubers.
Yeah.
And one of them is Shadiversity that I've mentioned a couple of times.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And not that I agree with everything he says or much, mm-hmm. but he gets you thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's inspiration, dude.
Yeah, that's what you need. And mm-hmm. RPG Pundit, I've listened to a few of his or watched a couple of. Really, I've listened to him because his whole video, he has the camera trained on either his books or his cat.
Yeah, yeah.
So oh, I like not listening much to of the a video. So, yeah. And he doesn't release it in audio that I've found anywhere.
No.
So I just usually sit it down and listen. I don't look at it the whole time.
I don't necessarily agree with every little thing he says, but I do. I like a lot of what he says.
Right. So he's had a couple on how to make gaming products. He's had some mm-hmm. on using mythology, authentic mythology. That was pretty inspiring. So, cool. So I've got that. And also there's something that we left off of here. Well,
oh, what's that?
On the browsing the internet kind of mm-hmm. blogs like Angry GM. We've used Angry GM a lot
mm-hmm.
and reading what other people think.
Yep.
You got to get out of your own head sometimes.
You do.
Cause you can sometimes think in circles. So it's good to read and listen to other people talk.
And let's be honest, we're our own echo chamber, so.
Right. Now, it's a good echo.
Of course. It's the right echo.
It's the correct way to think.
What about music? I put metal down. Dude, I can tell you, during the Seven Spheres campaign, every time I sat down to do my five, six hours of prep, which I did every 2 weeks, I turned on Disturbed. Put it on my three.
Disturbed.
I know they're not your thing, but I listen to them and dude, I'm like, metal.
Is it even music?
Dude, it is.
Okay. Are you sure?
I'm down with the sickness. Okay. Come on, Joe, get up and get down with the sickness.
Come on, dude. I don't even know what that means.
Oh.
That means.
Come on, dude.
I'm into, you know me, I'm mellow. So
yeah,
I do
Barry
like some heavy.
Barry Manilow, the Beach Boys. Does that inspire you?
The Beach Boys are okay.
I like Barry Manilow. Did I lie?
But it's more in the classic rock vibe.
My daughter used
Motown.
To
Motown. I also like Motown.
Dude, my daughter. I tell you what, I used to listen to a lot. And Madison, my daughter would laugh her butt off. I listened to Disturbed, and then I'd listen to Britney Spears. Then I'd listen to some Katy Perry.
Also,
listen.
Go ahead.
Female pop stars. It's not that I like a lot of it much anymore, but back then in the early 90s, mid 90s, I kind of did. I would go from metal to that, and I don't know why.
Me neither, because I'm going to have the same comment about Britney Spears. Is that even music?
Fair enough. I don't know what they're up to now. I don't know what even Katy Perry sings. I just know she kissed a girl once, apparently.
That and she fun. Liked it.
Yeah. So I guess. But yeah, music though, especially metal. I mean, it feels like combat for the ears, baby. How's that?
Well, there's that, but so different music inspires me in different ways. Gaming wise, like you can put sometimes different music can put you in different, metal states, like, Phil Collins in the Air Tonight.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh
so,
yeah.
So you can imagine that. I imagine it as background music as characters are doing things.
Yeah, imagine dark streets, moonlit streets in Sanctuary, right. City of Thieves.
So if your character is bent on revenge, then
oh, yeah,
that would be in the background.
Good song. Yeah, that's right. Money.
But
how about Lord of the Rings? I have the musical score.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm listening to that, it's completely fantasy. It's the archetypical fantasy, and that music takes me to that movie and that book, and I'm like, I'm in the mode of science of fantasy.
Oh, Conan the Barbarian score.
Yeah, good absolutely. Stuff. Yeah, good stuff. A lot of soundtrack stuff is really good for, especially when I'm music that I listen to while I'm prepping.
Right.
That's the sort of thing I always have music on.
Eye of the Tiger.
Yeah. Dun, 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 dun. Yeah.
Right.
Dude, yeah. Thank you, man. Bring that 80s stuff on. Anything else otherwise that inspires you, Joseph?
You do, man.
Oh, yeah, baby. You know it. I'm the inspirational.
You're the inspiration. That's a song, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it's you're the inspiration. That's a Chicago song.
Chicago.
With what's his face?
Peter Cetera.
Yeah.
It's the wrong context, slightly.
Oh, right. Okay. But besides music, is there any other things you can think of inspiration? I think we've listened a lot.
I think we hit it all, really.
Pretty much out of the park. This was probably the perfect podcast.
Yeah. We should get an award for this.
Yeah, we should. Yeah, the perfect podcast goes to Biggest Geekus episode 33.
There is an award show for podcasts.
A show?
Well, it's an internet show, obviously.
Really? I didn't know.
I have to. Let's see. I listen to the No Agenda show, and they talk about it every once in a while because they laugh about it. But
Is it for all podcasts? Or up for awards?
Well, I don't know about all.
I mean, do they do like categories? This is a sports talk.
I don't know all the
actual play. That's actually not a bad idea. It'd be kind of cool. Actual plays.
The Ennies might have podcast awards in it. I haven't looked.
Oh, yeah, they do. The Ennies have you. There's the best RPG talk discussion and best RPG actual live play. I think the discussion, because I think some of the ones we've listened to have won.
So then we are hands down winning an Ennie.
I think so. I think we're going to win next year.
Yeah.
So go ahead and vote for us.
Yeah. Well, we have to be entered.
Oh, crap. Good point.
Oh, well.
Oh, well. Yeah. CabinCon moment.
CabinCon. What is inspiring about CabinCon? Just the idea of it being around the corner.
I know, dude. I could just jump out of my socks, man. It's so close. A few scant weeks away. What are we at? 1, 2, 3 weeks away? Is that right?
Something like that.
Dude, I'm checking the calendar just to see what's up. We're going to start on a Thursday, so 1 week after tomorrow. Yes, it's 3 weeks from tomorrow, exactly. That is too much goodness. Yeah. You know, I'm also inspired. CabinCon inspires me to get my prep done.
Yeah, there's that because you're under the gun. Also, the kind of game, because it's a con in a way. It's not a
con-ish. You know,
it's con-ish.
Mm-hmm.
So one shots are really your best idea, unless we've come up with a couple of ways to have an ongoing thing going at CabinCon, a recurring CabinCon experience.
Ends up being episodic, but yes, that's about the best we can do.
We have a 13th Age thing. We had a Pathfinder thing.
Yeah.
But
I bandied about the idea of a Savage Worlds thing, but me and Patrick are still noodling on that.
But a lot of guys are preparing, in essence, one shots. I think we have a stable of characters for 13th Age that we will
revisit
play over and again. And it's not all the same. It's not in the same campaign, but there are a few 13th Age GMs. So
yeah, I don't know. Last year when I ran that one that ended
the Blades?
The Blades ended that one. That was a campaign for 13th Age, and that brought you guys into the Dragon Empire so that we can continue on. Pretty much everybody that was there last year had a character. So
just about everybody has one.
Yeah.
I started a new thing that I forgot about.
Mm-hmm. Your Dragon Mountain.
Dragon Mountain. So.
But it's set in the Dragon Empire.
Yes.
So it's part of that world, and they can play in that. That's very cool. I like it because there's a chance to play new games. like, I love when our boy Jason H came, and he was like a run. He was a GMing machine. He ran that Call of Cthulhu game. He ran that nonstop. I like a chance to play. I've not played Call of Cthulhu, but that one time. And I like a chance to play games that I haven't played before. I played Game of Thrones once. What else have I played? Some of Patrick's ideas I've played. What else have I played that was kind of Larry N will make a game that's his own little creation. It's a little
right.
post-apocalyptic. That's I've not got to play in that. He called
those
me.
Those are always weird. They always have weird stories.
Yeah, they do, but they sound like they have a good time. Yeah. So I'd still like to try them. I think that's a great thing. There's really no limits on what we could see there. I mean, and we, you know, we offer up board games and they're talking about playing Magic. I'm probably not going to do any Magic stuff, but I think it's great. We got so much to offer there. People do.
Yes.
Here's something I've mentioned. Is the inspiration greater before? Because that's inspiration before. I'm usually often even more inspired after Cabin Con. How about you?
Well, considering I go in pretty even keel, I pretty much come out even keel.
We got to do something with this even keelness. I'm definitely more inspired probably after. I think because it's lit a fire in me and I keep thinking, I want to do this. I want to do that. I don't always accomplish the things that I want to accomplish, but I am very much inspired to do cool and different things during the year before the next Cabin Con.
If I'm inspired in any way, it's to play more.
Yes, that tends to do. Yeah, we all talk about that, man. Right. We have got to play more, but this time it's happening. We're doing it. I believe. When you're running a game at Cabin Con, what inspires you to prep for it? Besides, you know, for me, it's friends. They expect the game. So I got to do it.
Well, yeah. And what I always try to think of is trying to do something neat because it's a one-time experience. Mm-hmm. So not just, you know, play through a module, though I've talked about that, doing a dungeon crawl in the evenings.
Yes.
Because it's just something we don't really do a lot.
We don't do much. It's like, and you mentioned how you wanted to get the Grand Temple of Jing, you know, get a mega dungeon and just run through it. And I tell you, you made a good point. So if it rolls around about 10 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock at night or 12, if I'm able to push myself, usually Saturday night, we're all pushing. I want to stay up super late because we don't want it to end. And people are like, let's do something. A dungeon crawl is easy to run. And if there's just, we're just going to run through a few rooms and see what happens. I think it does sound good. I think we have a lot of.
I do have take a mega dungeon already. I've got Rapanathuk.
Oh, do you have the original paperback version?
Yeah, I have a soft cover.
Soft cover, okay.
Yeah, I don't have the hardcover book.
I sold my original paperbacks. I probably shouldn't have, but I did. I thought about rebuying the full Monty for 5e or swords, probably Swords and Wizardry. That's probably what I would buy it in and just get the original, the full hardcover, but it's like 100 and. Plus
yeah.
bucks.
But I have it's a three volume
deal,
and I still have that. And you can run it with any D&D version. Mm-hmm. And there's ways to get quickly from one level to another, and just have some wild things happen. So
I think so too.
I think it might be cool to run it and not start the characters at first level, but have fairly decent characters, and just see how it plays out.
Didn't that first version of Rapanathuk, didn't that have didn't you say there was a room where there was a wand of meteor swarm?
Yeah, 30 charges.
Which by 3-0's rules, or that was not.
Maybe 50.
Right, and you get that well before you're like 20th level, right? That's like a.
There's no such thing.
What?
There aren't. Wand at the fourth level.
Correct. That's what I was saying.
You can get it fairly early in the dungeon. Like,
seventh or eighth level, and you have a wand of meteor swarms.
Yeah, yeah.
Your eyes would bug out of your head if I gave you something like that. No, here's what would happen. Joe would be like, "What's the catch, Randy?
Yeah.
What's the catch? So when I use it, what happens? I get it. I'm the center of the meteor swarm.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, yeah." Mm-hmm. I don't give that away, but I tell you, in that game, you should.
Right.
We should do a Monty. Oh, I ain't got time to prep it. Maybe I do. Do a Monty Hall, old school dungeon crawl. And what I mean is, don't go crazy, but just let the chips fall.
Mm-hmm.
Dude, if they get a +5 sword at second level, hey, dude's got a +5 sword. I don't know what to tell you.
This module, I'm pretty sure it's like a typical old school. module from first and second edition, first really, where you can just pick up all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. Well, it was by Necromancer Games. That's now become Goodman Games. I know, not Goodman, Necromancer Games. And they their moniker was third edition rules, first edition feel.
Yeah,
they
there were some issues with it, with some terminology and stuff, but it wasn't bad.
It's been written and rewritten for Pathfinder, Swords and Wizardry, and 3E or 5E too. Yeah. All right. Well, you ready to dig the setting? Yeah, man.
Well, we're doing Forgotten Realms.
Yeah, and so I just did a quick Wikipedia because I'm always wondering, Forgotten Realms, I'm always wondering, did it come out in first edition or not? Yes, it did. There was a 1E version in 87. There's been a 2E, 3E, 4E, and 5E version of the Forgotten Realms. And I call the 5E version because they've done Sword Coast Adventures and they've placed all their adventures in the realms. So I got a list of pros that are fairly big. Now, last week we talked about Greyhawk and we talked about how we preferred it to Forgotten Realms. I tell you what I liked about Forgotten Realms. When it first came out, I had the original red or green box. That was the box set. It was new. That was a plus. One of the first new settings. Secondly, Greyhawk was long in the tooth. I'd been playing that for a long time. It was high magic right out the gate. I remember reading about a mercenary company, the Flaming Fist.
Right.
Who made an appearance in Baldur's Gate, the video game. They had their leaders, who were a group of adventurers that were all 20th level. Fighter had a storm giant belt and a +3 hammer. And I was like, whoa. And so high magic was for real. It was a serious thing. It felt like a more, I use the word modern in my notes, modern gaming world. But it was more like D&D just imprinted on this world. Everything we thought was cool about D&D was there. It was just completely in your face.
Right.
Kitchen sink. I loved Greenwood's pages from the Mages and Dragon magazine back in the day.
Yeah, they were well written.
And you saw a lot of stuff in there that just felt like the way Greenwood would write Elminster talking. I thought Driss was cool initially. That may not be popular with a lot of folks. I thought he was pretty cool. When he first came out, he was a new kind of dude. This dark elf ranger that was a good guy.
Right.
And tons of material. Just tons. On one side, that's really good. I mean, I knew that I could, over time, especially during the second edition era, man, you were just bombarded everywhere. There was a box set for every region, it seemed like, in the Forgotten Realms.
Right. What was good, what was bad about Dritz wasn't Dritz. It was that the game designers insisted on switching over game, making game rules that made rangers just like Dritz instead of letting Dritz be a unique thing.
Right. And also what sucked is every player wanted to play Dritz.
Right.
But did you have any pros that you could say that you liked about Forgotten Realms?
Oh, I thought it was imaginative and very well developed.
Yep.
But at the time I liked it.
Yeah. Because of all the magic, it seemed to just like you should give magic. Magic is a thing. People have magic items.
I think it was over time I realized what I thought were the cons, which was it was overdeveloped.
Oh my God, yeah.
Now, I don't know much about the 4E version of the realms. Really, not even the 3E. We didn't really do a lot of realmsy stuff.
I have the realms box. I have the realms book from the third edition, but yeah, it didn't. It wasn't.
It was we mostly did it during second edition.
Yeah, we did. And I think it had better. I thought it was better developed in second. Well, it's crazily developed, like you said. I thought it was almost too massive.
Right.
I mean, you just felt like you had to.
The new source book.
Oh, and
multiple
and novels. The novels. Oh, every week you turned around, there was a new Forgotten Realms novel.
Right.
I think
one did not like the Dritz novels.
Fair enough. There was, he jumped the shark at some point. Mm-hmm. The second time Inchuri came back from death, I was like, oh boy. And I think everyone loved the novels and loved the material. Everyone knowing everything about the setting can make a DM feel a bit boxed in. You're not. I mean, as a player now, I wouldn't care. Like if Joe's like, dude, I loved the Belgariad series.
Right.
which you loved at one point, right? You might still do.
Yeah.
And imagine they made a box set of that, and you're like, oh, and you just absorbed it. And you're like, Randy, I want to play in the Belgarian world. And I read it. I said, Joe, you're right. Dude, that's really good. We're going to do it. I read the box set.
Right.
I said, I'll do it. I wouldn't feel obligated to make it like the books. And I wouldn't listen to Joe. He said, oh, that's not how it was. I'm like, that's how it is. You know, right. in my Belgariad world, this is how things roll. Right. I mean, Joe wouldn't be troublesome, but you can have players who know so much about it, or you could take a different tact. I could say, you know what? I'm going to lean on Joe. You encounter this thing. Hey, Joe, what would these be like in the book? Well, those creatures were blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, so you see this. And so I would literally use you as a resource at the table, like a Star Wars nut who right. would be a resource. So you got both. But I think as a con, it felt like that. I think there was too many high-level Mary Sues. A lot of people in our gaming group, they talk about that. All the high-level characters running around, it makes you wonder why anything evil can be accomplished with all the high-level good guys.
Yeah, well, Mary Sue is a character that is like what's her name from Star Wars? The new hotness?
Yeah.
Star Wars girl.
The non-Skywalker Skywalker?
Yeah. Starts with an R?
Ray.
Ray.
Ray, yeah, yes. Ray.
So,
she's actually a Palpatine.
So there's lots of high-level characters in Greyhawk or in Forgotten Realms, but they usually have a history that you figure out pretty quickly that they rose to power after, you know, some work. Ray didn't have to do no work.
No.
She just woke up. She became a force wielder and then all of a sudden was able to control people's minds and all this stuff. She only had a mentor for a hot second.
Mm-hmm.
He died.
Yeah.
And she didn't really get much instruction from him and then didn't have one after that.
Yeah. I tell you, I call them Mary Sue's. And that's probably not the right terminology, but just like there's so many high level characters that just, you know, I remember the first time I ran the realms with some of my guys at home in Charlestown. We started in Shadowdale, and they knew Elminster was there, and they run into a difficult situation, an adventure, and they went directly to him.
Right.
And they're like, obviously. Hey, we need your help, and this evil thing is happening. And I was like, I looked at Elminster, and his alignment's like neutral good. I'm like, why wouldn't he help them if he's home? You know, you can make that, I mean, as a young dude, I was like, why wouldn't he help them? And it'd be like, and I would say, well, I have more important things to do. And after a while, the player's like, yeah, that's dumb. It's really probably not, though. I mean, he's like, I got to be here just in case one of Manchun's clones starts starting some crap. And I got to get to it quick because he's an 18th level wizard. You know, and you could use that as an excuse. But if they're 8th or 9th level and some undead horde is sweeping into Shadowdale, Elminster would defend it.
Right, right.
And he'd be like, okay, meteor swarm.
Yeah.
No more undead horde.
Right.
And the lich is like burning to crisp. I'm like, I can't believe I survived that meteor swarm. And so it'd be like, it was kind of hard with those high level characters that you could do that. And I think the realms is cool and I could run a campaign in it, but I think that's some serious drawbacks. And a lot of our players don't like it because they see the high level characters as just like win buttons they're like every town you turn into, there's a 15th level wizard running it. And you're like,
well, what's the point of me?
What's the
point of me being here?
Right. Exactly. Cause you know, couldn't he just summon a couple of, couldn't take some of his apprentices that are 10th or 9th level and send them on an adventure. I guess you could play their apprentices. That'd be one thing to do, but yeah, I don't know. That does feel a little bit of a problem with it. I guess I don't really have too many memorable adventures in that setting. I mean, I tried to play it, but nothing about it is really memorable as far as playing in the setting. Some of the books and stories, I thought what was that God's trilogy where Mistra was dying and who was it? Kelimvor and Sirik and Midnight. What was that called that when they changed from first to second edition?
Time
of Troubles.
Okay.
Time of Troubles. I thought that was pretty cool as a story, but for a D&D world, whether it was cool as a novel, I don't know. I read some of it, but I thought the story was kind of cool. But they do that every time. The realms kept having a big novel to usher in the new changes of the versions of D&D. That feels a right. little bit like overkill.
Yeah. Yeah. To be honest, I think I have more poignant memories from Greyhawk than Forgotten Realms.
Yeah, I literally can't think of an adventure that I played in or ran that was Forgotten Realms memorable.
No, I think it just was background noise.
Yeah.
Forgotten Realms became kind of just a background noise to whatever we were doing.
Right. True. How would you rank this bad boy then?
M.
Yeah, I think mine's M as well. I might lean a little more toward large and that I'd be happy to play a full-blown campaign, but it's absolutely not the best choice. Probably lean more toward okay. I'd want to run
okay.
Yeah, medium, and it's just okay. I agree.
Yeah.
All right. So, go ahead.
So are we ready to move on?
Yeah, I think so.
Plugging?
Yeah, before you plug, you might want to tell them what we're going to do after the plug again. We're going to keep the negative playing.
Yeah, we're going to do the plug, do our end credits and music, and do the negative plane where we wax poetic about our not liking something.
Yeah. This time it's comic books.
Yeah. All right. So if you would like to support the show, I think I want to do something slightly different for plugging.
Do it.
And that's basically just saying, please spread the word. Tell your friends about the podcast.
Yes.
I don't care if you want to support us or not. At this point, we just want people to listen.
Yeah.
So just tell them about the podcast, and that'd be great. It would also be nice to hear from you.
Yeah. We love having Jason call in, and John Allen does her now and again. But anybody else, I mean, please call. It's cool. Leave us a message, good, bad, or ugly. We'd love to hear about it.
Because right now it only seems like we have two listeners.
Yeah.
John and Jason.
But, I mean, they're superstar listeners. That's true.
Well, to be honest, we have two financial supporters. So I'm sure they're listening.
They are too.
Amy and Trent.
Yeah, buddy.
One.
And Patrick.
Pat.
Yeah, man.
Pat and Joyce. We'll say that they're
joint. Yes, well, they are support. They are together. Yes.
Yes.
So we definitely appreciate that. But it's not about the money. It's just like, I would love to just hear from people. And like you said, spread the word. That's really good. I agree.
Spread the word.
Change this plug script out a little bit.
And we want to still shout out to our podcast that we'd like to talk about, Red Dice Diaries with John Allen Large and his wife, Hannah, and Radio Grognard with Glenn Hallstrom, Tale of the Manticore, which they just had a new release.
Yes, I'm down three. I'm going to be listening to that tomorrow.
You're behind.
I'm behind.
Should be ashamed.
I'm ashamed. I'm bowing my head in shame.
Tavern Chat with Eric Tenkar, although he's expanding it to, he's calling it lots of different names. So we'll just stay with Tavern Chat.
I got a title for Eric. He's the czar of the OSR.
Oh, there you go. You should tell him that.
I'm going to.
If he hasn't already heard it in the future.
True.
He listens.
He may have. You may have will may have. What's the proper English? Future perfect pronoun predicate. What? I don't know.
Something like that.
It's not calculus. I don't care.
Right. Nerds RPG Variety Cast with Jason and Shadow of the GM with Barry, who is thinking about doing a solo a solo actual play, so I've recommended to him Tale of the Manticore that he should listen to.
Oh, he's going to do one like that.
Well, I don't know. He just said a solo actual play. It may not be precisely because Tale of the Manticore is dramatized.
Yeah. It's more homie there does a heck of a job.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, so this is Joe.
And I'm Randy.
And remember, if you can't be big like us, then be geeks like us. So negative material plane time.
Transitioning, taking off the happy, happy cloak, putting on the dark cloak of evil. Not really. Comic books. I've lost a loving feeling, Joe.
Well, anytime I look at a current, anytime I hear anything about comic books these days, about the Marvel and DC, it's, you know, rife with social justice because that's where we need it at.
Dude, and who's that guy, Eric July, who does the he's awesome. Young Ripa 59 podcast, and he started talking more about comics. Now he's more of a mixture of that and political commentator. But he talks about tokenism. And I tell you what, the character that I was least bothered by, but I do agree with him, Miles Morales, the Spider-Man and Into the Spider-Universe. Here's the problem I have. You're just changing it up. Just to change it up. And you're not doing, at least, you know, the stupid crap with the New Warriors where they had those dumb characters like Safe Space and Snowflake. At least they're new characters. I'm tired of them trying to Bogart already known characters. And there's a series called, I've not read this, folks. I'm telling you, I've not collected comic books 15 years. I buy chunks every now and again. And I can't read stuff in modern comics because they have this one series, United States of Captain America. They've had a gay Captain America. They're going to have a black female Captain America. It's like they're going to be just, look at our diversity flag. We're going to throw it out there, and we're going to do all these Captain Americas. Can't you just do, I mean, at least in a place like DC, they can sometimes have the measure of intelligence to say it's an alternate world character. If it was an alternate universe, Earth 47 has a gay Superman, I'm probably going to say, okay, whatever. Okay, it's the world where Superman, okay. And the 45 million universes, sure. Okay, but no, they're just going to change stuff for no reason. Marvel's just like, Iceman's gay. Now, what I'd read was it was like, I don't know how they described it, but basically he came. The thing about Iceman, and he was a male horn dog forever. He chased the women. Then all of a sudden, oh, you know, I've always held, you know, been had these feelings, but I didn't want to come out because I already struggled because I'm a mutant. I read some little blurb about it on there on the line showing panels. And I'm like, oh, please. And yeah. Jean Grey had read his mind and said, why don't you come out, Bobby, and tell people? And I'm just like,
because all the superheroes are cool with it. All of them.
Yeah. Ain't none of them going to say nothing.
Right.
Seriously. But the point is, no, I just don't make your own heroes. Quit destroying my childhood. Quit destroying. I mean, it wouldn't even be now. I would still collect some now if they were readable. And they just tell these stupid stories that start out preachy, lay things out preachy. And that thing that happened with, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates, did you see where when he ran Captain America into the ground, then he ran Black Panther into the ground, sales dropped. Now, it probably is not all him. And then he goes after Jordan. Jordan. Yeah, it's fine. he goes after Jordan Peterson, who had a perfect comeback. That was
Hail
Lobster.
I'm
just like, you know, I don't know. They just can't. They can't. It's not like they can take. They're like, you know what? There's not enough diversity in comics. I'm going to start my own imprint. I'm going to start my own company. Like Image did years ago. And they immediately, because they got seven big artists and writers, and they were immediately competitive. Just, if your ideas are so freaking fantastic, you know, stand by your convictions, start your own company, and try to sell that crap.
Right. Okay. So the other thing is tell a good story.
Please. So
you could have Spider-Man be trans.
Yep.
But if it's about Spider-Man being trans, not Spider-Man being a hero and saving the day.
Right.
Then what you're doing is you're writing an activist comic. You're not writing a superhero comic. They don't need to have superpowers. Who cares?
Right. Just get up there and tell us.
If the comic is about their struggles as a minority of one sort or another, or a whatever.
Protected class.
If that's the story, then you don't need to be superheroes.
You don't need a comic book if you're just going to tell me a trans woman is a woman. Just say it, and then I'll move along. I don't have to buy, spend $2.99 to listen to you blast me for 30 pages.
Right.
Yeah. And like, there was a thing of Future State, which DC did recently, where they get a glimpse into the future when Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman have laid down the cape and cowl, which Batman I get, but Superman and Wonder Woman I don't get, because Superman is essentially immortal, and Wonder Woman is too. She is not going to be aged like any kind of reasonable thing. But let's say that happens. Then they brought out all these new, like for like 2 or 3 months, they had these issues with these new characters. And the Flash was someone named Jess Chambers, who was a non-binary they, them Flash. And they had a variety of, you know, a lot of that stuff in there. And I just, you know, I don't know. I'm not sure what happened. I don't know what they're trying to do, but it's just, oh, so now you're going to retire all these heroes that you're claiming at some point in time, we're going to get rid of Bruce Wayne and Clark Kent and Diana Prince. And we're going to go ahead and tell the Barry Allen and then tell news stories with all these goofy characters just taking over their shtick. And the problem I have with even Batman going away, these characters are immortal.
Mm-hmm.
They're timeless. If we were going by actual age, Batman would already be too old.
Right. He's been too old.
He's been around since the early 40s.
Mm-hmm.
So I got news for you. That makes him 60 plus 20, 80 years of crime fighting, starting out in his late 20s. He's over 100. Right. But he's not. We're just telling Batman's adventures. And I want Bruce Wayne to remain Batman until there is no, unless you want to kill him. If you decide you want to kill him, okay. But I don't want to see someone else taking up the cowl. I just don't.
Mm-mm.
I just don't want to see it. Let someone else be something else.
Right.
But I mean, that's a different story. But I just... The only hope on the horizon, well, you're the one that sent me the stuff about some of the new creator-owned stuff.
Yeah.
Sent me an email. Yeah, that's encouraging.
So, I got the website up. I thought I put the name of it there in the notes, but I did not.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty – I know that Dan Dixon, which is one of my – I think it's Dan Dixon. Is that his name? Or Dan Jurgens, one of them. I think it's Dixon. He was one of my favorite writers of Batman in the early 90s, and he's doing some of his own stuff. And there's a few other guys, and they're writing comics that aren't totally inundated with all this SJW tokenism, super lefty claptrap that I don't want to see when I read a book. I mean,
right.
And I don't want to see super right crap either. Don't preach to me about the praises of Trump.
Right.
I don't want to hear that either.
No.
Just tell me a superhero story. Come yes. on.
Yeah, that's the whole point of the comics is to tell a superhero tale.
And this bleeds into the movies. I mean, think about like, you know, Captain Marvel. I forgot where I saw this video somewhere on Facebook or somebody was talking about. I think it was Ben Shapiro. He made a good point where Captain Marvel, she meets this dude at the beginning of the movie who hits on her in the parking lot. And she grabs his hand and crushes his hand and punches him, or, you know, basically humiliates him and, you know, roughs him up in front of everybody just because he hit on her. And I'm kind of like, I just, okay, woman power, I gotcha. I just, the movie, and Captain Marvel, you're talking about a Mary Sue. Oh yeah. My God. Captain Marvel is the queen of Mary Sue's. And she, and her comic book is utter garbage, has not sold for crap. And they're acting like it was the greatest movie in the world. And Marvel has the formula down. So Captain Marvel as a movie was passable. And I think that that's the best you could say about it.
Right.
It was passable.
Most of the reviews I saw, they all trashed it.
And while I like,
I didn't watch any.
Right.
I'm sure you probably had some movie reviewers from the left that were like praising it like it was, you know, Oscar worthy.
You looked at Rotten Tomatoes, it's probably got an 80%, but I mean, get out of here.
80% with the reviewers and 2% right. with the other folks.
Well, I have to say the other folks had a problem with Black Panther. I thought, and it's not because he's black and nothing to do with it. I love Black Panther as a kid. I read a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked the actor. I forgot the one that passed away. Mm-hmm. He was fabulous as T'Challa. But I enjoyed the movie. But to say it was like the best, I've seen it ranked as one of the best Marvel movies ever. And I'm like, it was not Captain Marvel. It was good, but it wasn't Iron Man.
Right.
It wasn't Winter Soldier. It was not Endgame, nor Infinity War, nor Doctor Strange. It was none of those, you know.
And Doctor Strange wasn't that great.
No, but it was enjoyable. It was enjoyable. I think it was better than Black Panther. Now, Black Panther is not poop like Captain Marvel.
Right.
I would say Black Panther is probably just below Doctor Strange or equal to Doctor Strange. I think, honestly, I thought the first Ant-Man was better. I enjoyed
that
crap.
That was a good show.
It was hilarious. It was one of the better ones. Thor. Oh, Thor Ragnarok. Holy crap. What a hilarious, what a hilarious roller coaster that was. That was brilliant. So, you know, it doesn't compare to those. It's not even close to those. It's a normal, solid. Now, had it been made in 1984, yeah, it'd have been the greatest superhero movie in history. At least we would have thought so. But not today. It's not up to snuff. I'm sorry. No way.
Would you rate Blade better than it?
Blade's pretty old. I have to see it again. I said, I like the acting. I like the story. I even like the villain okay. Mm-hmm. I thought Black Panther was top notch. Absolutely loved him. And was a Winter Soldier. I thought he was absolutely fabulous. I loved T'Challa. Always had. The dude was perfect. But I don't know. It just wasn't. As far as if I'm ranking Marvel movies, it's in the upper third. And that's it. That's it. Somewhere near the upper third to the middle third. It's not. Captain Marvel's probably the worst. Out of that first Hulk piece of crap they made with the dogs.
That was bad.
But, well, you know what? To be fair, Captain Marvel's probably in the upper of the bottom third. Because it wasn't like it was pure poop. They had the formula down.
Right.
But she was just.
And Samuel L. was in it.
Yeah, he was funny. And I love the two little. Was that the one where they had the two Kree or not Kree?
The other one.
Kree was the. They made them the bad.
It wasn't Kree. It was the race of creatures that were after the Kree.
And which is funny because in the comics it was kind of reversed.
Yeah, the Kree were bad guys.
The green guys were the bad guys.
The
Skrull were bad.
Yeah,
but in this one they were displaced, you know, refugees.
Obviously.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, they had
because
that.
Because obviously the Skrull represented some other marginalized group, and so they're problematic. So instead of making the Skrull out to be the bad guys, kind of like the books of D&D being made out to be black people, which they're not.
Right, which is stupid.
The Skrull were given a more sympathetic background.
Yep. Did you put that one talk about with the creator-owned comics?
Yeah, that was a comic. The one that I found was Comic Artist Pro Secrets. Is the name of the and he's an independent comic artist.
Yeah, they're like a frog character, but I tell you, and our buddy Greg T had said that he was supporting independent comic people now too because of this.
Right.
And I think that's where I have to go.
Yeah, you might want to talk to him about different titles, but the funny thing is the guy's YouTube address. Is youtube.com/user/fascistfrog. Well, because the frog there's a frog in partially in the graphic.
Yeah.
At the homepage of the.
Has a frog main character. I was looking at one of their Indiegogos and it's a frog character. I forgot his name. Superhero with the frog.
It might be this guy.
Yeah. But yeah,
anyway,
you know.
Yeah, the frog because of the frog that Keck from Kekistan frog that's on the internet.
That, I don't know that.
Okay, there's a green frog that I'm pretty sure it was developed by an artist. And then these folks kind of said, oh, we'd like that frog and we'll put him in our online stuff. You know, they're doing trolley stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know the details very much. But because these guys didn't buy into the left, they were labeled as white supremacists, and the frog by association was now a white supremacist symbol.
Yeah.
Because reasons.
Right.
Who knows? The left makes weird associations, and that's one of them. And so they leaned into it instead of shying away. Mm-hmm. And which that's what this guy is doing. He's leaning into the frog. It's just a stupid frog graphic. That's
right.
Kind of like Jordan Peterson.
Right, with his lobster thing.
It's the lobster thing. And so he leans into that. because it's fun, not because there's any deeper thing. It's just fun.
Right. Well, you have to have fun with them when they start coming after you because there's nothing else to do. You can't take them serious because the cancel people are just stupid beyond belief. So,
right.
You know, it's funny. One last thing I want to say about comics with the alternate universe stuff. And I'm serious. I would not be bothered if they had all, you know, DC is known for its Crisis on Infinite Earths. And when I say Infinite Earths, they have Earth 53 and Earth 91 and stuff. And you could have one where one of the, you know, Batman's transgender and one where this is that. And that's fine. I don't care. But you know what? What they wouldn't do if they did that? I'd love to see them have an alternate universe where Superman is a devout Christian.
Right.
And Wonder Woman is his wife. And she obeys the scriptures as a wife would obey the scriptures and defers to her husband.
Right.
I mean, you know, submits in the sense that she willingly does that to honor God, not because she's weak, but she just does that to honor God. They won't do that. What they would do is they would have him be a quote unquote Christian, but he's super, you know, he's Trump-like and he's trying to control people and rule the universe. Look at him, oppress all the minorities because, right, you know, Christianity is evil and stuff like that. But they wouldn't do that. They would never do that. Even just a guy that's even a Superman or a Batman who's like, who's a fair-minded, leans libertarian, is about open-mindedness and freedom and true freedom, like for everybody and live and let live. And they wouldn't do that.
No, they wouldn't.
No. They have to pick on one side or the other. But
back in the day, in the 90s, I think, maybe a little before that, read a little bit of Alpha Flight.
Yeah.
And they had North Star.
Yep.
And he was gay.
Yes.
But who knew? Because it wasn't part of the, it wasn't in your face like the angst of being gay.
He came out in a comic as gay, the first gay superhero, and guess what? Then he went back to be a North Star, the superhero with his sister Aurora.
Right.
And they didn't go crazy about it.
Right.
And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was like, whatever. I mean, it's like they didn't go, here, let's make a special 6-issue miniseries where you talk about how he struggles with his homosexuality and comes out and dates all these dudes. And it's like,
who cares?
He has a boyfriend. Good for you. Let's move on. Tell me a superhero story. I want to see him running around kicking people's butt. Don't talk about that. I don't care.
I mean, there are comics where they're more like soap operas, but those aren't superhero comics.
No. There might be a place for that.
Yeah, but it's not. Comic. It's a superhero comic. It has a particular purpose and a job.
For my money, it does. If they want Randy Nichols money, they need to tell superhero stories. They need to be cool stuff, drawn well, striking the pose, beating a bad guy. That's what I want to see.
Right.
So, anywho.
And they went away from that. But then that's the problem. That's why there's two reasons why I think that they tokenize existing characters.
Yeah.
One is because they can't tell new stories. They don't know how.
Right.
If they could, they would. That's why the snowflake, whatever that one is, that's why they came up with that, because they really couldn't come up with their own stories. There's worse ones, actually.
Yeah, I know.
And can't remember the name of it, but I was like, this can't be a real comic. And it is. And there's another reason is they want to subvert Western archetypes.
Yeah.
Western story archetypes. The hero's journey is a Western story archetype.
Yep.
They want to do away with it because it's problematic.
Yep. Yep.
It's white people storytelling. So because white people tell it, they can't do, you know, and they're bad.
They can't do justice to anybody. So if white people tell it, it's bad. But yeah, I don't know. But the sad thing, and it's really sad when I say I've lost that love and feeling, it hurts me because I still, even since I've been here in Michigan the last 20 years or whatever, I periodically grabbed a handful of books and was excited about it.
You get trade paperbacks.
Trade paperbacks. I love to read them, and it was good for a while. And then New 52 came in for DC, and I was like, and then it just started being inundated with all the woke stuff. And I'm just like,
When was it then you got into, what's his name? Spawn.
Oh God, that was back. I was still married. In the 90s, I was married to my first wife. I was living in Bloomington, and I picked it up off. I was shopping in a Kroger, and they had the old style comic spinning rack, and I saw issue 3. I hadn't collected comics for years. I mean, it had been since, you know, undergraduate. I'd been collecting comics early undergraduate, so 6-8 years. And I saw that comic book, and I saw Todd McFarlane art, and I was like, dude, I don't know who this Spawn is, but that's a beautiful comic. And Image was getting started, and I saw another one, Youngblood or something, so I snagged them, and I went out and searching for issue two and found issue two and then found issue one, and I was like, and I collected Spawn for like 60 issues. It got stale. It was really only good for about 20, but I'm a little hard to let go. But it got me back, and I collected a lot of the early Images, and I collected Valiant, then I got into DC again, and then I took a break and came back, and then started doing trade comics when I got to Michigan. And then now I just can't even look at them anymore. Well, I'll buy them if they're old stories, reprints of old stories that I know are good and I don't have them, or one that looks like, oh, this is from Blackest Night, which is when Green Lantern was written, like, back in the 90s. The 90s is kind of the end for me, when they really were telling very good stories, maybe the early 2000s.
Right.
After that, it got stupid. So,
well, maybe indie, just start diving into indie comics, make you feel better.
Yeah, I think I will. Yeah. All right, man.
So just to let you know, guys out there, I don't care if you're gay.
Nope, don't care.
But superhero comics are not about being gay or being straight or being trans or being any of that stuff.
It's
about being superheroes.
Yeah, so just do tell that story. If you want to have a gay superhero, that's fine, but make him a hero.
Yeah.
Make him cool. You know?
And since Marvel and DC seem to be moving away from that, folks like us who like reading heroic stories.
Yep.
We're probably going to have to read other sources.
Yeah,
we got to read other stuff.
And I hate losing, but you know, I got my old comics. I got plenty of collected trades of the heroes that I know and love back when they were the heroes that I know and love. So I got plenty of them I haven't read yet. Probably 2 dozen. So I got plenty to read.